Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend, UFC Vegas 50. We're already at the big 5-0 coming at you from the Apex. We have in the main event, Thiago Santos take on Magomed Ankalaev, and that light heavyweight division is completely wide open. As always, one half your host and duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, at Matt Allen FNP in the gray on gray. It's like the denim on denim of sweatpant apparel. But Matt, when we look at the fights coming up this weekend, I know we talked about it last week with UFC 272. Obviously, the pay-per-view card, it gets a lot of the shine. It was ultimately a very interesting and very profitable card for many. The question mark kicks parlay hits. We have a big time positive weekend, and it continues the role of 2022. Sometimes the years start incredibly negative and then we bounce back, but this year has been a good start so far. But we said it on that show, I mean, this fight night card so far, it's been the best one so far, at least on paper. I'm really amped up for this one coming.
I think it should be a really fun fight. And even the new addition of Terrence McKinney versus Drew Dober, I think fits into this card tremendously. That's going to be a phenomenal fight. And everybody is really hyped up about Terrence McKinney. And that's the fun thing about this card. You've got some vets that are trying to get a title shot in the main event. You've got some fun prospects up and down this card. It just kind of has a mix of everything on this, what, 14 fight card. So it is a very loaded one, but I'm excited to break it down.
Loaded card, Sung Yadong taking on Marlon Moraes in that big time co-main event. We go down through it. So many great matchups. We throw it on over to our fight of the night screen. And again, with 14 different fights, it is pretty difficult to choose just a couple of them. You let us know down below who you've got as a possible fight of the night. Plenty to choose from.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
And when we're talking about a possible fight of the night, let's just go to possible fight of the year, at least a contender to remember. We have Alex Pereira taking on Blindado Bruno Silva, the former M1 Global middleweight champ. He had a long layoff due to USADA suspension, comes into the UFC, and it's just been guns a-blazing for Bruno Silva. He hasn't missed a beat. Two performance bonuses in his last two fights. And if you look at it for his opponent, the former inaugural, I guess you could say, glory simultaneous multi-weight champion. He was the middleweight champ over there and the light heavyweight champ before losing his belt shortly before making his UFC debut against Andreas Mihailidis. Gets it done, jumping switch knee to get the knockout in the second round there, a performance bonus in his debut. He was also a featured prelim on a big-time pay-per-view card. I love this fight. And we have a lot to say about it, but I think as far as a fight of the night, like, this one could deliver here.
Of all the fights on the card, on this card, I'm fairly certain the judges can stay home for this one. You have Alex Pereira, who people are just sort of penciling in as the second best striker in the division right now. It's, oh, well, he beat Israel twice. He could do it again in MMA. And I know there were a lot of question marks about, oh, how are his skills going to translate coming over from kickboxing to MMA? But he looked pretty darn good his last time out. And it will be really interesting because Bruno Silva is arguably the most dangerous knockout artist in this division. And he's not even a ranked fighter yet. But this is a big opportunity for Pereira. If he is able to beat Silva, that's a massive jump up in competition from Mihailidis in his debut, and it probably gets him a ranked opponent in just his third fight if he is able to win this weekend. So I think this is a huge fight for both guys, and not just an exciting one for the fans, an oddly important one for both guys in their career.
And if you think about it, Kevin Holland with his big win over Alex Oliveira, kicking it at welterweight, there's going to be a spot available in those rankings in the next couple of weeks to be penciled in. So big time opportunity for both of these guys. And you hate to cherry pick off of the co-main event. When we do these, we like to sometimes go with a hipster's pick. But in the co-main event, you have Marlon Moraes, now training out of Tiger Muay Thai, taking on Team Alpha Male Sung Yadong. And for Sung Yadong, kid's on a roll. Like, it's insane. This is a guy that also happened to come into the UFC the same year as Marlon Moraes in 2017. They threw one guy into the deep end off the hop. They gave the other guy an opportunity to breathe. But now we ultimately end up here in 2022. And for Marlon, 1-4 in his last five, but he's shown flashes in those four fights, especially the fifth to last fight against Henry Cejudo. For Sung Yadong, draw there, wins here. It's been an impressive run for both of these guys. I'm really looking forward to this fight.
Really tough level of competition for both guys throughout their UFC tenure. And you're right, Marlon came over and immediately started fighting the best of the best. But even for Song Yadong, being as young as he is, he still fought some really good fighters during his tenure in the UFC. But this is the definition of a crossroads fight. Marlon has been in the top 10, top 5 for a while now. And he has started to lose when he has faced some of these up-and-coming contenders. And for Song Yadong, we all know how exciting of a prospect he is. He's not just a really talented fighter, he's an exciting one too. And there's nothing the UFC loves more than someone who puts together wins and does it in impressive fashion. I think this is going to be perhaps a showcase fight, but like you said, in every single Marlon fight, he has that one big moment that sort of brings you back to his championship form. So I think this will be a really fun one.
Great opportunity for both of these guys. Let us know what you make of the fight of the night screen. You have 12 other fights to choose from. Toss those down below in that comment section. And all in all, and as Fight Night cards go, 6 ranked fighters on this one. You have Yusuf Caceres, Moraes Yadong, and in your main event, your 2 light heavyweight contenders. You also have the UFC debuts of AJ Fletcher coming in at 9-0 out of Lafayette, Louisiana, training partner of Alan Jouban and Dustin Poirier. You also have Azamat Mirzakhanov, who's been booked with Marcin Prakhniau, Jared Vandera, and now Tafon Chukwe. I'm really looking forward to that. The former Brave CF Openweight champion over there from 2019, and a guy who was booked to be in the UFC in 2017 against Joachim Christensen, USADA Kamanakan. And then you also have Javed Basharat, a very, very impressive Taekwondo fighter who really lays it all out on the line
really
once he starts
style.
To find his flow. He really is. So a great one there. Second looks of Kamwela Kirk, Cody Brundage, and Chris Moutinho, a guy who gained a massive Instagram following off his Fight of the Night performance and a loss to One Sugar Sean O'Malley. But Matt, we said it from the start. We said it last week. We've been hyping this cards up, and it's not one of those ones that we've had to hype ourselves up for. There's a lot of depth on this card.
I'm really excited for Drew Dober, Terrence McKinney. I feel like this is a much bigger opportunity for McKinney than most people are letting on right now, because Dober is a ranked fighter and a very good one at that, and one who is well respected in the sport. Like, he has a number of quality wins. So for McKinney, on what, 8 days notice, he can really make up a lot of space in this division and get his name into the rankings. Like, Ferrisium beating him is one thing. Like, it's impressive, and he showed off a new wrinkle of his game with his submissions, but beating Drew Dober really proves to us that, wow, you are ready for those top 15 guys. So I think that's a phenomenal fight on the main card that I could not be more excited for.
And Drew Dober coming off a Fight of the Night performance and a loss to Brad Riddell, where he got out-wrestled by the striker. It was a weird
great
one.
Fight, though.
For sure, but a great fight nonetheless for McKinney coming off of that big, big win over Ziem. Gets his leg kicked out from under him, somehow bucks off in the scramble and ends up on top. Great wrestling out of McKinney. We have so much to say about this card. We want to thank you so much for joining us. If you care to toss a like and a sub, we certainly would appreciate it. But Matt, I can't wait for this card. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Light heavyweight finishers battle it out. Coming up this weekend, we have Tafon Dedan Chukwe taking on Azamat Mirzakhanov. The nickname's The Professional. I think it's a lame nickname, but the guy definitely handles his business in the cage. He is 10-0 as a pro, the former 2019 Brave CF Openweight champion. Like, we're throwing it back to the days of pride. Who is he? Mirko Krokop? I know he doesn't fight that way, but if you look at it for Mirzakhanov, a very, very interesting prospect coming into the UFC. I mean, the guy's already 35 years old. He was supposed to debut back in 2017, just getting a straight shot to the UFC to take on Joachim Christensen. Who knows? This could be, in a bizarro world, the Azamat Mirzakhanov era. He could be a champion,
wow,
but we would never know. He tested positive for boldenone back then, so they decided to give that a little bit of a hiatus before that debut. If you look at the 5-on-in for Mirzakhanov, he is the lone man to go out there, and the last man to go out there, I should say, and finish Andrea Muniz. That was back 5 years and 4 months ago. Wins over Georgi Sakayev, Guto Innocente, Mohamed Fakhreddin, and that was back in that Brave one-night openweight Grand Prix. He was able to beat Innocente and Fakhreddin to win that belt. Then he has a long layup between the Fakhreddin fight and Mateusz Scheffel over on Dana White's Contender Series. That was week one. We'll also talk about another week one guy who's on this card a little bit later on. But when I look at this fight, Matt, for Azamat Mirzakhanov, you look at him, He's coming over from Russia. He's trained in New Jersey for the longest time. K-Dojo Warrior Tribe has really put this guy on a bit of a poster. You can find on their own YouTube channel videos from years ago where he's training, where he's doing like the hockey player thing or the CrossFit training thing with the ropes. But for Azamat, to me, he looks like an in-shape John Volante, but he really is a lot more than that. He can work in his team.
I would hope so. If he was any less, he wouldn't be in the UFC,
from,
Craig.
From southpaw, he does kind of throw a really nice lead jab to throw his left overhand. He can mix it up with his striking, and that's what I love when I watch these Azamat Mirzakhanov fights.
He does have really nice power on the inside, but what he does struggle with sometimes is setting up those inside power shots. He does have a good jab, but sometimes he does struggle with the accuracy of it, and it's something that would be nice. It was almost reminiscent of watching, like, Colby Covington last night. Colby Covington looked great. It's hard to dock his performance in any way, but let's be honest, his striking into the clinch wasn't the most refined that we've ever seen. Mirzakhanov can fall into some of those holes where it's I'm kind of reaching on some of these punches on my really long range, but once he is able to get his footwork right and get on the inside, he does have really nice power with his hooks and with his uppercuts. It's going to be really interesting to see who's the person moving forward in this fight, though, because with Tafan Chukwe, we know how good of a striker he is and just how explosive of a striker he is, but he is one of these unique strikers who he doesn't have the best volume in the world, and honestly, I wouldn't even put him in the top tier of like power punchers because he does need to set up his power shots a little bit at this division. So I do think it's really going to be a key for Tafan in this matchup to be the one moving forward, because if he's the one pushing Mirzakhanov back, and listen, that's easier said than done, because all Mirzakhanov knows is moving forward, not taking a step back. But if Tafan can start getting some forward momentum and really implementing that body and leg kick that we've seen throughout his career, I think he can have a lot of success throughout this fight. But I really do think the person moving forward is going to be the one having the most success.
And for Azamat Mirzakhanov on screen, you can see it, the fact that I was a little cheeky and I went with 216.5 pounds. He was scheduled to take on Jared Vandera not that long ago, weighed in for it. Vandera weighed in for it, and then the fight was scratched, and Vandera ends up with Andrei Arlovsky, and here we are with Mirzakhanov taking on Chukwe. Even before that, he was scheduled to take on Marcin Prachniau. That fight fell out, would have been at 205 pounds, but for Mirzakhanov, that is the latest weight, so they say. And I look at it, I mean, again, the fight against Shuffle where he's able to drop him, was Herb Dean asleep at the wheel on that finish? Like, he really should have called it a little bit earlier than that. And for Tafan Chukwe, that's the point. I mean, the weirdest part about him is he's 6-1 as a pro. You look at it, 3-0 as an amateur, all finishes and all fairly quickly. And then when he's a pro, again, Alex Myers, A.T. McCowan, William Knight, Al Matavau, all knockout wins. But his last three fights have been a decision. And the weirdest part about it is, too, if you look at it for the man himself, Tafan Chukwe, Alex Myers, A.T. McCowan, William Knight, all of those fights above 205 pounds. Now, he's weighing in that 225, 235 mark when it's at heavyweight. William Knight, that was a catchweight fight. When William Knight was off of Contender Series on a developmental deal and he loses to Tafan, the best part about Tafan's game, though, and this is really the highlight of it, two-time national WKA karate champion in 2016, two-time champion in 2017, two-time 2016 world champion, and also a 2017 IBJJF silver pan medalist. And you like to see all of those well-rounded things out of Tafan Chukwe, and this is where I'm going. In the Alex Myers fight, Myers goes 0 of 8 in takedown attempts. McCown goes 0 of 3. William Knight's not able to work the takedowns. Tafan Chukwe's a good striker. He's had good takedown defense outside of the UFC. Jin Young Park able to kind of get rid of that mystique a little bit. But when Tafan is having his most success, it's like this slow, plodding forward style. He's able to close distance with some of his power. And when he does land and he's able to bring in combinations, he really is a force to be reckoned with. But he's more than just that karate background that he has in his back pocket.
He just doesn't have the volume, though, and it really is frustrating watching him. I do almost liken him to, like, Paul Felder was one of the best examples of this, because Paul Felder doesn't have one-punch knockout power, and he doesn't have the best volume in the world, but he's good in both areas. So he did have to throw in combination or hurt his opponent later on in the fight to really make the most of his fighting style. Where Tafan kind of lies on that spectrum is, I do have big power if my opponent's moving towards my combos in a lot of cases, which will present itself in this matchup. But I don't know if I'm confident enough in Tafan to be able to throw those combinations round after round after round. And with his takedown defense, it is interesting. I think he's almost so focused on defending the takedown that he's not letting his hands go because of it. Because, like you said, he does have really good takedown defense, but it's almost like he's so cognizant cognizant of, okay, my jiu-jitsu's not great. I do need to worry about wrestling in a lot of cases because I am such a pure striker. I think it is almost holding him back a little bit with his own striking repertoire. And we've seen this before. It happens at higher levels where wrestlers can drop really good strikers because the threat of the takedown's there. I just think with Tavon, it's a hesitancy in his own striking that you don't love to see from someone who is a natural striker. And when you look at his two wins in the UFC, Jimmy Pickett, who has looked better, to be fair, but he got dealt with quite quick by Kyle Daukaus not that long ago. He beat him, and Slim Mike Rodriguez, who one day can look really good, and one day could lose to a guy coming off Contender Series. So, and Chukwai really does need this win, and I know we always say that when someone's fighting someone making their UFC debut, but I feel like for Tavon, there was maybe not a crazy amount of hype coming into the UFC, but definitely more than most. So I do think that this is an oddly important win for his career.
So as I mentioned, I mean, he had the fights at, you know, in and around a catchweight, or sorry, cruiserweight, 225, 235. Then he has the fight against Almadovao on Dana White's Contender Series. In the UFC, he fights Jamie Pickett at 185. He gets the win. He loses to Jun Young Park at 185. And then he moves back up to 205 his last time out against Slow Mike. It was a good performance. He went 3 of 3 on his own takedown attempts. He landed at 145 of 240 total strikes, and he had 4 minutes and 45 seconds of control time. You like to see that. Not necessarily sure how those openings would present themselves, though, against a guy like Mirzakhanov, who has a master of sport and hand-to-hand combat in his own back pocket. And I really do like the takedown abilities of Mirzakhanov, who at 35, at some point, we're going to start to slow down. I know he doesn't have a ton of miles on the clock at 10-0, but you watch the way that he fights. He bounces on his feet. He really is a light fighter. So the movement goes to Mirzakhanov. The grappling, I give a slight edge to Mirzakhanov. And then when it comes to the volume, the one thing that scares me out of Mirzakhanov, I think his last fight on Contender Series with the long layoff that he had against Scheffel, it was about 2 minutes and 30 seconds of nothingness. And then when Mirzakhanov decided to turn it on, he goes out there and he gets the finish. But in a fight against Tavon Chukwe, who is able to realize, I don't need to fight in front of this mirror anymore? That's really going to be the kicker in this one.
Exactly. And I do think Mirzakhanov is the more well-rounded out of these two guys. And honestly, I was going to say he has more power. I would say Tavon has slightly more power, but you get the idea. If Mirzakhanov can get on the inside, it's going to be very equal. I just worry about Mirzakhanov leaving himself open on some of those entries. That is going to be one area where he could lose, really, to anybody in this division. Like, anyone who weighs 205 pounds when they get an opening like that, if they land clean, they can win. Like, OSP made a career out of just making guys make mistakes and then finishing them in brutal fashion. So I do worry about Mirzakhanov once he does start to fight the more skilled guys in this division, but I do like him in this matchup.
Dana White's comparison for Tavon Chukwe on Contender Series was that he has a little bit of that Mike Tyson to his game. So if we have a look at the odds for this fight, Mirzakhanov opened the underdog at a plus 125. He's a minus 150 right now. For Tavon Chukwe, open a minus 145. He's a plus 124. So the odds have completely shifted. If we have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us as they are to you, I'm going to say over-under with Mirzakhanov as the favorite now. 65% Mirzakhanov, over under.
Under.
You're going to say under, and it is over. 518 total votes, 79% Mirzakhanov, 66% have him to win by knockout. For the 21% that I have Chukwe, 50% by knockout, 45% by decision. 5% think he's going to get the submission. Maybe it happens. It would be a surprise to me, as it is to you, as I say. And I would shoot a whole thing of Da Bomb hot sauce if Tavon Chukwe is able to submit Azamat Mirzakhanov. For me, I like Mirzakhanov in this matchup. Again, I think the movement is going to be key. When you're looking at Chukwe, he can create some angles with his striking, but it is the movement and constant movement of Mirzakhanov. Unless he gets himself forced up against the fence and in some of those tight positions against the cage, I don't see him having as much of a hard time in this matchup. So for me, I like Mirzakhanov, and I really do like the, you know, amount of combinations or the differences that we see in the striking from Mirzakhanov, fight in, fight out. Has a really good leg kick as well. So a lot of different looks you can get out of him, and I'm going with him in this one.
I like him in this matchup, but I'll say this. I don't think he's going to get into the rankings, and I know he's 35, so that's not some hot take by any means, but I do really worry about some of those openings he leaves on the feet because they are wide. And in his fight on Contender Series, you're you're right. He didn't really prove anything in that matchup. Like, nothing happened, and then he scored the knockout, and it was over. So, I do worry about what we're going to see once he does face adversity, especially at the UFC level. So, I think this will be a good stepping stone for him to start his UFC career, but I do like Mirzakhanov.
Mirzakhanov coming in here with that hype of, like, a Clinton Abreu, and we saw what happened to him in the UFC.
Crowd goes mild.
But both of us going with Azamat Mirzakhanov. In this fight, you let us know down below who you have. Is it Cameroon's Stefan Chukwe? Is it Mirzakhanov? You got a big time slate of fights coming up that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And we always say, let's get into it. What can I say about this fight other than the fact that it seems like it could be a loser goes home match, Mr. Perfect versus Ric Flair on Raw style? We have Ninja Guido Canetti coming in at 42 years old at bantamweight. He's a man. He's 42, taking on Chris Moutinho, and I get it, the Mike Gundy reference kind of applies in this sense, because for Guido Canetti, if you look at it, he's been in the UFC for what seems like forever, and it was long periods of inactivity during his career that kind of got him caught, but the craziest part about it for Canetti, he comes in off of the Ultimate Fighter Latin America Season 1 with that Michael Gilmore-esque rub. I mean, he loses to Marco Beltran, loses to Alejandro Perez, who ends up winning that season. Then he fights Henry Briones at UFC 180, and what happens?
Got finished.
Well, gosh darn it, he loses that fight and he gets finished too, and I don't know what he had, what kind of dirt he had on the UFC, but they kept...
Sam Alvey dirt.
They kept Guido Canetti around. So Guido in the UFC is 2-5. It's salty as it gets, but almost like Marlon Moraes that you're going to see coming up in that co-main event slot. Guido, even in the fights that he loses, he has these little windows that you go, wow, Guido, he's an interesting fighter. And I mean, he is, because he's fighting out of Our Town MMA in Argentina, not one of the bigger gyms out there. He is on an impressive strength and conditioning regimen. Now, I said that about Michel Prezeris before his last fight. He was all over the socials, lifting the weights. But Guido, insert the picture here. I mean, yeah, the guy's shredded. You love to see it, especially for 42. But you look at the fights that he's had, the two wins that he's got, Hugo Viana and Diego Rivas, neither one of those guys are in the UFC anymore. But in the losses, like Henry Briones, who I get it, not in the UFC, but Kyung Ho Gong, Marlon Vera, Dana Bakari, and Mona Martinez, those guys are all still very much in the UFC. And even in some of those losses, just a second, the Dana Bakari fight where he starts off a little good, and then he goes out there and gets flatlined in the first round. And then the Mona Martinez fight where it's like, okay, first round, Guido looks great. He's pumping those leg kicks out there. You always have to worry about that great left hook that he has of his own. You got to worry about that right that he pops out there, mixes things up, really goes well to the body, to the legs. But I'm selling you, like, world championship.
Yeah, you're his hype man right now.
I'm selling you world championship Guido Canetti. If you include those fights on The Ultimate Fighter back in 2014, when he was 30 friggin' 5.
What would his record be, Craig?
It's salty. I mean, we're talking 2-7. 2-7, if we consider those since then, 8-8 total.
Exactly.
It's not good.
That's my big point about Canetti. Why is an 8-8 fighter in the UFC? And I understand we don't count contender series, or not contender series fights, but Ultimate Fighter fights, because they are exhibition matchups. But you get the idea. He's 8-6, midway through his career, had two exhibition bouts, loses them both, and he's still in the UFC. And I'm not here to tell you Chris Moutinho is all of a sudden going to be some top 15 guy in the future. But let's just state what we know about both guys. Guido Canetti has a really strong start. He's extremely physically strong, has nothing for a gas tank, though, at this stage of his career. And honestly, at any stage of his career, he didn't really have much of a gas tank. And you do see it in all of his fights. You're right. He gets off to that really good start, kind of burns all the gas in the tank, and then kind of coasts for the rest of the fight. And against some guys like Mona Martinez, who aren't at the top of the division, you can get to a decision, and it was split. I still thought Mona Martinez was able to get the win.
Adelaide Bird, the 10-9 kicker in the second round.
But in most cases, like, go back to the Marlon Vera fight. He looks pretty good against Marlon Vera early, at least for the first couple of minutes. His physical strength really is a key. And then the second his cardio falls off a cliff, and guess what? I'm here to tell you, it happens in 99% of his fights. It's happened in all of them. He does really start to fade hard, and that's when he does get finished. And against Chris Moutinho, who isn't the best grappler in the world, isn't the most refined striker in the world, and isn't really a power puncher either, so he is going to have to rely on the longevity of this fight. The one thing he did prove in his last matchup against Sean O'Malley is he does have really good cardio, and he does have a pretty good level of output too, because that's the one thing that a lot of people did gloss over. Yes, Moutinho ate an ungodly amount of damage, like he ate hundreds of strikes in that matchup. He hit Sean O'Malley with a couple decent strikes, and I know we're just trying to nitpick a few positives here and there, because let's be honest, it was a very negative experience, I would imagine, for Moutinho, but he did have a few moments in that fight where he was able to close the distance on O'Malley, even late in that third round, so that does give you a little bit of confidence against someone like Guido Canetti, who does tend to gas in his fights.
And a negative in terms of, yeah, you lost for Chris Moutinho, huge following on social media out of that fight with Sean O'Malley.
True,
it was on a pay-per-view main card, a Conor McGregor card. Maybe it was an Ode Osborne card, too. We don't know, but, well, we could tell, but when we look at it for Chris Moutinho, the craziest part about it for him, when I look at his overall body of work, it's you're losing to some better fighters. I mean, Tony Gravely is on the record.
Really good fighter.
He gets completely out-wrestled in that one. He gets finished. He loses to Johnny Campbell, a guy who's been there and done that on the regional scene for a very long time. Some nice wins in his last two fights. Andrew Salas took all of the damage before it ends up on the mat. And then you have Moutinho getting the submission. But again, out of Moutinho, doesn't have great striking defense. And this is just peel back the curtain outside of the Sean O'Malley fight. Doesn't have good striking defense against lower levels of competition outside of the UFC on the regional scene. Doesn't have good takedown defense, striking defense. Throws good for his volume and has all right takedowns of his own. And he's a decent grappler. And he's a guy that's trained out of Regiment Training Center. Head coach Jorge Rivera, you know, the guy that Michael Bisping spat at his corner that one time in that fight a long time ago. And he's lately started refining his skills at uppercuts boxing. So I threw that there in the picture for this fight. But really neat out of Chris Moutinho. This, I will say, is one of the harder fights to try and gauge. Because again, for Guido Canetti, the craziest part is, if you consider those fights on The Ultimate Fighter, he's 8-8, but they don't count. So 8-6. Positive strike differential, good striking accuracy, good offensive grappling, good defensive grappling. Yet he's 2-5 in the UFC. Like, it's just funny how
which
things
would imply that he's not good at all that, those things you just said he was
yeah,
good
that,
at.
Yeah, that's it. It is funny when you have a good sample size, and he's lost against decent fighters. But again, now we're taking on Chris Moutinho. For Chris Moutinho, a great opportunity to just hit that reset button. And do you think, I mean, for Moutinho, he loses to Sean O'Malley, he goes on the Pat McAfee show. If Guido Canetti beats Chris Moutinho, do you think Pat McAfee and AJ Hawk?
You asked me a lot about Pat McAfee, and I've never watched his show. I probably not. No? I don't even no, Guido Canetti probably doesn't even get recognized in Argentina. That's not true. But I don't really think he's that big of a deal. I just think this is one of those classic boxing fights where the UFC realizes Moutinho did get a little bit of hype after his last fight against Sean O'Malley. So what do you do with a guy who's probably on what we can call a league minimum contract in the UFC? We could probably get him a decent, easy matchup his next time out against a 42-year-old who, like you said, is 8-6, but kind of also 8-8 in his MMA career. Like, this isn't a great matchup for a UFC level fight, if we're being honest. But I do think that I do think the cardio of Moutinho really does set him apart. I think defensively he is a good enough grappler to where it's not like Canetti's some monster on the mat where he's gonna submit you just like that. So I do think Moutinho can hang with him at least for one round, weather whatever storm Canetti brings, and then I do think Moutinho can start to pull apart late.
Guido Canetti open to -125, favorite he's a +116 or thereabouts right now in best fight odds. For Moutinho, open to +105. He's a -140. And yeah, this is a really tricky fight. We have a look at the Tapology votes. I'm not going to leave them up for a surprise. 550 total votes, 77% Moutinho, 76% by decision. For the 23% that have Canetti, 77% by decision. And when I look at this fight, Chris Moutinho is not a power guy. He's a volume guy. And that's one of those games that if you can get Canetti on the back foot, if he doesn't really hit you, if he's not able to land that lead leg kick, you could have a great time out there. But for Guido, the opposite, he's a guy that, yes, he loses to Mano Martinez his last time out there with Martinez. I expected him to knock out Canetti in the first round, and he just came out a little flat. Obviously, the Saul Solis stuff was weighing heavy on his mind. You look at it for Canetti, he was originally due to take on a big-time guy in Mario Bautista, and then he ends up with Martinez in that fight, so a little bit of a different look there. But a guy who's gotten finished early in his fights, I'm eager to see how he hangs in there. It seems like we have our minds made up, though, on this one.
I watch every UFC card, Craig, and I have no idea who Hugo Viana is, one of Guido Canetti's two wins. So that tells you what his level of competition is with his wins in the UFC. I do think this is not a rebuild fight for Chris Moutinho, but I do think this is sort of to help him retrace his steps, get back on the winning track. Again, I don't expect him to get in the top 15 anytime soon, but I do think Moutinho could have kind of maybe a Kyle Bochniak-like career. Is that a good comp? Or
he could have MMA?
Yeah, he could just have fun fights with guys, stick around for a little bit, but I don't really see him as having the highest ceiling in the organization.
Give me the guy who's 13 years older to win the first round and a little bit of the second round, enough to sway the judges, and then give up the third round. I've got Guido Canetti in this one. Again, I like Sean O'Malley. I like Chris Moutinho with the volume. I'm eager to see how he's able to withstand a lot of those lower body attacks out of Canetti. I really do. The boxing of Moutinho, it continues to get better, and I expect us to see a little bit of that in this fight. You talked about it. He definitely had some good success his last time out against Sean O'Malley with the hands, surprisingly to some, at least to me anyway, because O'Malley was a giant, giant favorite in that fight. But I will go with Argentina's Canetti in this one for the reasons that I have stated. So split on the pick on this one. But again, you look at some of those fights on that XMMA 4 card that's coming up shortly, and this one stacks up with those ones.
Hugo could walk into this room right now and I'd have no idea who he is.
That guy? Huh?
He's one of Guido Canetti's two wins in the UFC, and I've never heard of him. Like, I don't even know if he exists.
It is absolute wildness.
Tough. Yeah. I think Chris Moutinho, this is a setup fight for him. I do think his cardio really will pull him apart. Guido Canetti hasn't won a second round in a hot minute, so if you are relying on him to do that in this matchup, it might be a tough one, but I do have Moutinho.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup of very unranked bantamweights. We got a big time card coming up and some top ranked bantamweights in the co-main event between Marlon Moraes taking on Song Yadong. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
It's judo and college wrestling coming up this weekend. We have Cody Brundage making a second appearance in the UFC after an unsuccessful short notice call-up on a pay-per-view card when he took on Nick Maximov. Unfortunately for him, he came out on the losing end. He woke up that morning with Factory X in the background deciding, hey, I'm not a wrestler, I'm a kickboxer. And he kickboxed in that fight. He struggled a little bit with some of the wrestling. Maximov, ultimately a wet blanket, able to win the decision there. But luckily for Cody Brundage, he's taking on Dalcha Lunjambula, who doesn't wrestle the way that Nick Maximov wrestles whatsoever. With Dalcha, he has that judo pedigree. He was on the national team for Congo way back when for a few years in the old judoka, and you love to see that out of Dalcha Lunjambula. We saw that in his fight in his last time out against Marc-André Barriot, where it was a quick over the shoulder toss he was able to get. Now, for Barriot, to his credit, he was able to get back up to his feet fairly easily, but out of Dalcha, you're going to see some of those attempts if we do see a clinch early on in the fight. As the fight goes on, that power bar starts to go down quite a bit, and that's where Dalcha will tend to start to fade. But Dalcha, what do we know about him? This guy, former EFC light heavyweight and heavyweight champion. How did Alain Badeau make out against him at light heavyweight with EFC? He went sleep, sleep, good night, sweet prince, and a guy who had a rough run in the UFC, one of the worst we've ever seen in the UFC's heavyweight division.
Shout out to Frank Train Hamilton.
But if we look at it for the man himself, Dalcha champion in the UFC, it's been a weird mixed bag. I mean, he comes in, knocks out Daquan Townsend, beats him with the ground and pound. You love to see that. Loses to Magomed Ankalaev, where that head kick was on point.
Beautiful.
Then he beats Marcus Perez in a fight where, hey, Marcus, former LFA champion, so there's that. And then he goes out there and he loses to Marc-André Barriot. Again, for Brundage, a loss to William Knight, where he's having success early. He's able to get the takedown and then ultimately ends up getting finished. He beats Joseph Cropshot over with LFA. And then he loses to Nick Maximov his last time out. Unanimous decision. Again, it's one of those fights you can kind of make an argument, but no, you can't. The tricky thing when you look at it, though, Dalcha, champion from another organization, pedigree of competition wasn't actually that bad for Cody Brundage. The combined opponent record outside of the UFC, 33-34. That also includes the two fights against Lozano, who was 13-15 and then 13-16 after he lost to Brundage the first time. So it is one of those fights. Again, for Brundage, you're only going to get better having been a guy coming from the middle of the country, then moving your way over to Colorado Factory X. Your striking, your timing's only going to get better from going from Scorpion Fighting Systems over to Factory X. But again, his bread gets buttered with his wrestling. That's a tough ask against a guy like Dalcha Lunjambula.
We disagree on this, and I know we do, so I'll just say it. I don't think Dolcelyn Jabula has the greatest judo for MMA at all times. I do think he struggles defending more wrestling-style takedowns. When guys try to take him down with the shoulders, with the top of the body, yeah, he looks really good. But you can single-leg Dolce in an MMA fight. And it's not impossible to do. And he doesn't have great cardio at all. But I'll be honest, I really thought Dolce was going to have a much better run in the UFC. I know he came over a little bit older. We might be critical of some of the guys that come over in their 30s making their UFC debut. But I really did have higher hopes for Lin Jambula because he does have that really unique combination of, I'm a good offensive grappler. I am kind of unique with my style of grappling. And he does have phenomenal hand speed and power too, especially early on in his fights. But it just hasn't been the best run for him. And I know earlier on in these prediction videos, I made a point to talk a lot about the output of Tafan Chukwe. Lin Jambula does kind of fall into that, where he'll have these minutes of inactivity in his fights where it's almost like he's waiting for his opponent to really open themselves up for him to land a big counter. And against someone like Cody Brundage, who is an improving striker, but I still wouldn't say he's at the level of someone like Dolce at this point in his career, it will be interesting to see if Dolce can land early on in the fight, because this is a big step up in competition for Cody Brundage, and I'm glad that you brought up what his combined record was of his opponents coming into the UFC, because it wasn't great. And for Dolce, not to say he's been there and he's done that, but like you said, he was a champion outside of the UFC. That means something. There's a certain level of confidence those fighters have coming over to the organization. But I do think stylistically, Cody Brundage has a very clear path to victory in this matchup. If he can weather that early storm from Dolce and really implement his wrestling, not even secure takedowns in the second and third round, but just get Dolce's arms burnt out in the clinch, I do really think Cody can have a lot of success the later this fight goes.
Lin Jambula, the former EFC light heavyweight, my goodness if he cuts a lightweight, and heavyweight champ. Cody Brundage, the reason I put my hand up, the former lights out middleweight and light heavyweight champion. You love to see it, especially when you have this fight coming up at middleweight. And obviously with Dolce Lin Jambula, he's taken the Jared Cannonier route of things from, well, it was light heavyweight, then heavyweight, and then back down to light heavyweight, and now to middleweight, where I guess you could say he's found a home, but where he hasn't necessarily found a home is a spot to train in the States. I mean, he trained out of Extreme Couture here recently. He had the Dewey Cooper connection, old no right hand sleeve, loves it. And listen, the guy coached a champion now, so that's pretty cool, in Francis Ngannou. But when I do look at it, he's training out of Sanford MMA for this camp. We talked about the picture before Marc-André Barrio's fight with Chidi and Joe Kouani, but Marc-André Barrio now training with Dolce Lin Jambula, so you do like to see that. But I do like that. I mean, with Dolce, you look at that fight against Barrio, and it's not just recency bias. It's a microcosm for the way his grappling works. It's the first over toss or toss over his shoulder. That's the first takedown he gets against Barrio. The second one, he grabs the arm, and as he's pushing Barrio back, he's got his other hand behind him and then trips the lead leg and trips him down. So unorthodox takedowns that you don't see all the time in MMA from Dolce Lin Jambula, but from Brundage, we're going to work for a double leg. We're going to work for a single leg. We're going to work for those more traditional takedowns. Two-time NCAA D2 qualifier is Brundage. He has high school lineage in the wrestling as well. So when I look at this fight and the odds, Lin Jambula opened, well, they both opened at par. Lin Jambula now a plus 109. Brundage around a minus 128. And actually, I have those mixed up. When I look at the odds for this one, they open at par. Lin Jambula, a minus 128 or thereabout. Cody Brundage, somewhere around a plus 105. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, I'm going to leave it up to a surprise. Lin Jambula is the more well-known commodity, so I'm going to say over-under 70% Dolce Lin Jambula.
I'll say under, but I think he's the favorite.
The fans, they know him. 504 total votes, 81% Lin Jambula, 56% by knockout. For the 19% that have Brundage, 73% by decision. For Lin Jambula, again, 2-2 in the UFC. For Brundage, the one fight against Nick Maximov. And the last time we saw Brundage out, he was all about those sleeves on the lower half, the old ankle sleeves. What do you make of an ankle sleeve?
I played a lot of basketball growing up. I never wore any shooting sleeves, any of that stuff. I thought it looked ridiculous. In grade 12, I guess I wore leggings under shorts because Kevin Durant did it, so I thought that looked kind of cool. So that would be my one experience with it.
That's it.
Did you have any cool hockey accessories?
No, I have none. I wear a mouth guard. That's it. But when it comes to this fight, again, Brundage brings that traditional wrestling. It's something that Lin Jambula can kind of have a hard time with.
I brought that up in the Marcus Perez fight, and you may have said it was one of the dumbest things I've ever said on this channel. I just think it's kind of funny that now we have seen Lin Jambula struggle with that type of wrestler. But I will say this, and I'm really glad you brought it up. Marc-André Barriot is a more improved version of Cody Brundage. They fight in a similar manner, but I'd say Powerbar is kind of better at everything, and I know...
That's the least controversial thing ever.
No, but I know that's a hard hill to die on because of what he looked like in his last fight against Joe Kawani. He didn't look good at all in that fight. But I do think that him training with someone like Dolce and with him being a carbon copy almost of Cody Brundage is really going to help Dolce Champ in this matchup. But I will say this. I've got Lim Chambula, but he's going to drop the champion nickname. It's like when Jeff Van Gundy, everyone calls him coach still. Is it like... I know once a champ, always a champ, but, like, Joanna doesn't go by it anymore.
For Cody Brundage, Nick Maximov went 4 of 15 on his takedowns for 9 minutes and 21 seconds of control in their last fight. Dolce Lunjambula does not grapple like that. Dolce, what he will do, he pumps the jab out there, he doesn't throw a ton of kicks, he stands heavy on his lead leg, and he throws his right arm from an unorthodox angle. It's not full extension overhand, right? It's like... He kind of keeps it cocked and throws it, so he's got to be in close proximity, which is odd because he has a reach advantage in this fight. So when you need to close the distance with a short overhand right, which, again, go back and watch the Badeau fight. It's full extension in the overhand. But lately what we've seen out of him is it's shorter bursts. That could be a Dewey Cooper thing, so we'll see what Sanford does in this one. I'm going with Cody Brundage in this fight to get the win as the underdog against Lunjambula. I just think if he's able to implement some of those leg kicks, work in his wrestling, make this a gritty, boring fight, he should be able to cruise his way to a decision in this one. I mean, for Dolce, again, at 34, you're 2007 all the way to 2009 Congolese national judoka. You love to see that, but for me, I like Brundage in this one ever so slightly as an underdog.
I think Brundage can wrestle his way to a victory, but I do think he's going to struggle a lot with the striking early on in the fight. And I do think that if Dolce can get to an early enough lead, this is going to look similar to the Marcus Perez fight, to where he can do enough damage early, defend some of those early takedown attempts, and it might not look pretty come second and third round, but he'll just be able to do enough to get by in the judges' scorecards. So I do like Dolce in this one.
Middleweight and light heavyweight. Ooh! They're in some type of a spot. We're split on the pick. I'm going with the underdog. A Brundage, Matt, you're going with the champion to become a champion once more. We'll see what happens coming up this weekend. Big time card. Nonetheless, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Former top prospects looking to end their own respective two-fight skids. We have the Colombian Queen, Sabina Mazo, taking on Fear the... Miranda Maverick, and it's been an interesting road so far for both of these fighters. I mean, you look at the 5-1-in, they're each 3-2. You look at the 3 wins for Sabina Mazo, Shanna Dobson, JJ Aldrich by split decision, Justine Kitch, Bellator's own, and you see Justine Kitch training a little bit with Sabina Mazo now in Southern California, and Sabina Mazo's training adventure is going to be a theme of this video. You look at it for Maverick, a win over Pearl Gonzalez a couple years ago, gets her that ticket to the UFC. She gets a win over Liana Joji, the doctor's stoppage. She beats Jillian Robertson and really does a good job of out grappling her in the first and second round. Then she loses to Macy Barber by split decision, or does she? And then she loses to Erin Blanchfield on short notice, where she got completely out grappled in that fight. So when I look at this one, obviously for Mazel, again, the two losses that she has, I should mention Alexis Davis, who was a complete wet blanket in that fight, and her last time out she gets submitted by Maria Agapova in the third round of their fight. Now obviously, that one really ages like milk, especially the way that Agapova looked last weekend against Marina Moroz. But when we look at this fight, Matt, the biggest key to this is these are complete polar opposites stylistically, these two women, wouldn't you say?
They really are, because Sabina Mazo is someone who really does rely on her distance and her kicks to have a lot of success in the octagon, whereas Miranda Maverick is someone who really needs to get on the inside, use her dirty boxing, use her grappling, use her clinch work. But that's the problem about both of these fighters. We're starting to see them struggle in the areas that are supposed to be their strengths, and that's why I think this fight is very important, because you have two prospects who were fairly hyped up at one point, who have sort of, you know, lost their footing a little bit, and they both really do need this win. But I look at these prospects in very different lights, and you had kind of touched on it. Miranda Maverick had a very close fight against Macy Barber. I'm not going to be one of these people who just disagrees with every split decision, but I thought Miranda Maverick did win that fight. Now, if you do look at her last fight against Erin Blanchfield, Blanchfield beat the brakes off her, completely outgrappled her. There was no argument whatsoever for Miranda Maverick winning that matchup. But we did see her get outgrappled, but that was only one fight against another top contender in this division. And Blanchfield, I do feel like, has finally crossed over from just being another prospect to being one of those, like, oh wow, you could really be a contender in this division now. Whereas for Sabina Mazo, Alexis Davis Even that loss you can kind of throw out because, of course, Alexis Davis beats Sabina Mazo. She's just sort of built to beat fighters like Mazo. I move forward. I get better as the fight goes on. Just those classic Alexis Davis attributes. So Mazo struggles in that matchup against the vet. But her last time out against Agapova really does worry me just about the future and overall ceiling of Mazo, because Agapova's proven that she's not... You hate to say someone's not UFC caliber, but I'll just leave it open-ended like that. And for Mazo, she is going to really struggle against the grappling, I think, of Miranda Maverick. Because if someone like Agapova can get you to the mat and submit you, Miranda Maverick's whole game plan is work my way onto the inside.
That's not exactly how it happens. So in that one, Agapova drops her. And then she submits her, and in the fight against Davis, Davis takes her down three different times, is able to get a bevy of control time, almost two full rounds of control time in that one.
Yeah, and that's why I think she is really going to struggle against Miranda Maverick, because Maverick fights like a younger version of Alexis Davis, but she does have some of the better attributes of Agapova if you want to pull some of her strengths out. Again, I just want this fight for Maverick just to sort of reset her onto the path of being a top contender. Because, again, I'm always going to bring up this quote from John Anik when he said, after she beat Leona Jojua, this might be the second best women's flyweight in the world. And that was an overreaction at the time, I think it's fair to say. But that was the type of hype that people had associated with Miranda Maverick. And that just tells you what people thought of her ceiling all the way back then. And I know we don't normally get to the odds until after, but I didn't look at the odds before we did this breakdown. I'm glad to see they do respect Miranda Maverick for what she is, because their last five fights, they do have the same record, both 2-3. But I would say Miranda Maverick has looked better in her last five fights.
And I mean, if you look at it for Maverick against Blanchfield, she was actually the underdog in that one for Blanchfield. She was going into that fight originally supposed to be taking on Macy Barber. Maverick tries to try to jump the line and get that loss back, so to speak, against Barber. And if you look at that Barber fight, Maverick won the first round, Maverick won the second round, Barber wins the third. If you look at it in terms of what the judges scored, D'Amato and Dave Hagen gave round two to Barber 20, all 20. Everybody on MMA Decision scored at 29-28 for Miranda Maverick. So it was another one of those ones. We have them every single weekend, just like you had last weekend with Nikolai Negomirianu and Kennedy and Shukwu. These crazy decisions, and nothing ever happens because the same people judge every single weekend. But when we focus on the good out of both these fighters, for Mazo, output and distance, when it's on, it's on. She has a range and a height advantage over just about everybody in this division. She has 4 inches of height and 5 inches of reach on Maverick in this one. She's been working at Fountain Valley High School on her wrestling with Coach Pete Escudon. And then you look at it, she's been also working across the country at Teixeira MMA and Fitness, getting ready for this one. I saw that.
Slowly becoming a powerhouse.
Yeah, with Alice Pereira, a glory fighter, and training with Jocelyn Edwards and Justine Kitch over there in Southern Colorado. So for Mazo, really trying to switch things up, get better at not just the things that she's already good at, but trying to defend some of the wrestling. And if you look at it for Miranda Maverick, still training in Colorado at Pound for Pound Fitness in the adjacent gyms, but Justin Houghton over there, Raquel Pennington, JJ Aldrich, Drew Dober that we're going to see coming up this weekend, Tisha Torres, Shanna Dobson, and Jessica Aguilar, who's still around the gym.
Jag.
So we look at the odds for this fight, Matt, and Mazo open to plus 130. She's plus 226 on best fight odds. For Miranda Maverick, open to minus 150. She's a minus 282 or thereabouts, actually replacing Mandy Boom on a bit of short notice in this fight. And if you look at the Tapology votes, not a surprise to anybody. 430 total votes already, 91% Maverick, 87% by decision. I just don't see Sabina Mazo being able to defend those takedowns early.
It'd be like if they did Matt Brown versus Santiago Ponzinibbio. It's like, well, yeah, Matt Brown has a couple ways to win, but oh my god, this is a bad matchup. Just stylistically for Mazo, she struggles with pressure, she does have the best takedown defense, and she's shown questionable fight IQ once the fight does hit the mat. Miranda Maverick can take advantage of all three of those holes in her game, and I do expect her to do that. And I do think that Miranda Maverick will be a top 15 contender in this weight class for a while, whereas I don't think Sabina Mazo is going to be around even from like the 25 to 15 range, if I'm trying to be really nice about it. So for Maverick, I do think she will get her name back into that sort of contender matchup. But I will say this, the perfect fight for Sabina Mazo in this matchup, if I do expect her to win, she's going to have to fight like Caitlin Chookagian. Get on your horse, fight moving backwards. You can use your kicks, but you're really going to have to set them up at the end of your combinations so that Maverick is really guessing a lot throughout this fight. But I do like the forward pressure a lot from Miranda.
Good opportunity to get back on the right track for both of these these women, the 3-2, the 3-fight win streaks, bookended by two losses, or at least ended by two losses, both of us in this one, going with the state's own Fear the Miranda Maverick to get back on that right track. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight. It would be a surprise if the Colombian Queen does get it done. We get some big time fights coming up in this card. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
With Joshua Culibao out of the matchup with the Leech Damon Jackson, in steps the Jawaian Camuela Kirk, coming in from Siege MMA down in Arizona. And he's a big time test against Damon Jackson. And Damon Jackson's one of those guys that if you go back and you look at the overall body of work, it's the weirdest career. Like, it's two UFC runs. He's not on the third like Julian Arosa, but they are still in the same weight class. There's more wins than there are losses. And if you go down and look through it, he's been favored to lose in a lot of his fights, but he just continues to win. Like, I look at Damon Jackson's career like I look at King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. Yeah, Damon Jackson seems to fight every weekend. King Gizzard, they have an album every other weekend. They have more wins than they have losses, and I enjoy that out of both of them. So, different musical tests. Damon, when he comes out, the only difference is you know what you're going to get out of him. And with that nickname, it really is fitting. Now, I don't know if he gave himself the nickname, like I'm sure Maria Agapova gave herself Demon Slayer, because there's no way somebody comes up to you and goes, hey, Demon Slayer, cool. But with the Leech, he does fight that way. So the first run through in the UFC, he beats Leonard Garcia with Legacy to book his ticket in. And then he goes out there, loses to Yancy Medeiros, gets performance of the nighted against. And he goes out there, has no contest with Mr. Hani Jason. He then draws against Levon Makashvili, and the UFC decides, you know what? See you later. We don't need any more of this. So he fights his way up and on through. He has some fights with LFA again. He has some fights with PFL. But then he comes back into the UFC and he takes on Mirsad Bektic. And in that fight, he was a plus 295 underdog. He wins it. He gets a performance bonus. It was amazing. He goes out there his next time out. He takes on Ilya Topuria. He's a plus 195 underdog. And he gets completely outboxed. So then in his last fight, he takes on Charles Rosa. He was a minus 190 favorite. And somehow he pulls out the win in that one. I was surprised it wasn't a draw, but listen, if we learned anything out of Damon Jackson's last fight that we might not have known otherwise, this guy's tough as f***. Do you think Damon Jackson, Billy Q, and Julian Arosa can combine to form some greater MMA fighter who could probably challenge Francis in, like, a big trench coat? Because I really do think that all three of those fighters are cut from the exact same cloth, and they do a very similar style. I'm going to pressure you with my boxing, and it's not going to stop. And the second you want out, be it because I'm hitting you in the head, or you're just tired from all this pressure, and when you shoot for a lazy takedown, that's when all those fighters can take advantage and even either get you with a submission, get into top position, or just ride the round out in the top position. They're just great in every area of the sport, but I would say they're sort of in lesser degrees. I would say Billy Q is probably at the top end of this category, whereas Damon Jackson's more at the bottom. But he did beat Mirsad Bektic, who at one point was a top 10 fighter in this weight class. And I know Mirsad has been on the receiving end of a lot of crazy comebacks, or been on the wrong end, I should say. Everyone, excuse me, is going to remember Darren Elkins, his crazy comeback at 209. 209? Yeah. It was one of the craziest fights you'll ever see. And then, of course, the Damon Jackson comeback. But it was a comeback, and that's what people forget. He was on the receiving end of a lot of takedowns in that fight, and I know the good thing about Damon Jackson is that you don't really look at his takedown defense numbers and think, wow, he's a poor grappler just based on the numbers. He is a good jiu-jitsu player who doesn't mind working off his back, so he will give up the takedowns sometimes in his fights, and he showed it in the Bektic matchup, where as that fight went on, Mirsad got a little bit lazier and a little bit lazier with his takedown attempts, and Damon Jackson was able to secure that guillotine. And the more I'm talking about it, add Gerald Meerschaert to those four guys could all do the Spider-Man meme with each other. But Damon Jackson, he never has been respected throughout his UFC career, and that just kind of is the last point. Like, you had mentioned it, he's always the underdog in every single fight, but just skill-wise, like, take Damon Jackson out of it. If you just looked at his skills, well, he's good on the feet. He's got good grappling. He's got a pretty good chin. I know he got knocked out by Ilya Topuria, but that's going to happen to a lot of guys. The most disgusting knockout ever, Mavlut Haibulayev.
But you don't look at Damon Jackson and his game and think, wow, there's a ton of weaknesses there. And that's why I think he's always going to be an interesting matchup for anybody in the division, just because he can always offer you something no matter where the fight goes.
And I mean, when it comes to Camuela Kirk, he comes in there, he's taken on Makwan Amerikani. And, yeah, I mean, I give myself close the fight. Pat on the back, but it really was a close fight for taking Kirk as an underdog. So if you look at it, Again, MMA decisions, 13-1 had it, 29-28 for Mach 1. Amir Khani, your judge, Dave Hagan, scored that contest 30-27. So that was kind of wild. But for Cam Wallace-Kirk, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in his own right. And he really is another one of those guys that's very well-rounded. And the best part about him is his wrestling and then his grappling, that really comes first. But we've seen his striking continue to get better as his career's gone on, throwing in combination, mixing things up. And if you even want to go back and talk about a guy that you had already mentioned in Billy Quarantillo, if you look at it for Cam Wallace-Kirk, he beat Billy Quarantillo in the first round of their fight on Dana White's Contender Series. So after that, he gets pummeled in the second round. But after that, he loses a split decision to Bruno Souza, who's, of course, now in the UFC, and a lot of people thought that he won that fight. He beats Guilherme Santos after that, beats Daniel Swain after that, beats Mach 1 Amir Khani. But if we back up to the Daniel Swain fight, the best part about it was Cam Wallace-Kirk was talking about, like, I'm going to make this guy quit before fight.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to make this guy quit. And between the rounds, Daniel Swain saying to his corner before the last round, hey, I want to quit.
No,
so
boss.
It was kind of crazy to see that. But for Kirk, again, good wrestling, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And I think in this matchup, the grappling could actually cause him problems with Damon Jackson. He's that big of a grappler. And we saw Damon Jackson get the respect he deserves, I guess, from odds makers, from the fans last time out against Charles Rosa, being almost a 2-1 favorite. But in a matchup like this, even though Cam Wallace-Kirk is much younger in his MMA career with less experience as a pro, I like how good his striking's come along lately.
It has improved quite a bit, but I do like the steadiness out of Damon Jackson. I do think grappling-wise, Cam Wallace-Kirk can have some success early on in this fight before he has started to tire, but that's how I do view this matchup. I do think they are similar, oddly enough, in a lot of the ways that they do fight, but I do think Jackson, he's just a better fighter when he is tired, I guess. He still gets tired. His hands still get low as the fight goes on. But he just is able to maintain, I guess, his prime form. I know that's a weird X factor to have. But I do like the tired version of Damon Jackson. And I do think that no matter what version of the fight this looks like, he could be up 2-0. He could be down 2-0. He always is going to have that, ooh, off his back. He is really tricky with the submissions. And hey, it's not like he can just go out there and submit Cam Wallace-Kirk like that. That's going to be really hard to do. But I do think that as the fight progresses, Jackson can have a lot of success with his grappling. I do worry about him on the feet, though, and I do like what you brought up about the improvements in Kirk's striking, because if you can catch Jackson early, and I do think that is the case, because once he gets warmed up into a fight, it is hard to stop him. He does roll quite well with punches, but if you can catch him early, he can get knocked out, and I do think that's going to be a good path to victory for Kirk.
Kirk with a win over Kevin Kroom by submission on the regional scene to get him onto Dana White's Contender Series, a loss to Anthony Backham. He won that fight, and then a split decision loss to Kyle Reyes before that. So all of his losses, with the exception of the fight against Quarantillo, are by decision. When we have a look at the odds for this fight, Jackson opened the favorite minus 145. He's a plus 128 or thereabouts on best fight odds. For Kirk, open plus 125, minus 155 or thereabouts. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over-under, actually, on the more experienced fighter here with Damon Jackson. I'm going to say 63%. Damon Jackson over under.
I'll say under.
You're gonna say under, and look at that. Look at that. 467 total votes, 69% Jackson, 70% by decision, 21% by submission. For the 31% that have Kirk, 66% by decision, 25% by knockout. I think Cam Wallace-Kirk wins this fight. I think his wrestling is another giant X factor that we don't focus on. Now, if he gets his back taken, why did you wrestle, Cam Wallace?
Mirsad's pretty good at wrestling, too.
And Mirsad Bektic is quite good at wrestling. But I do like Cam Wallace-Kirk in this matchup. And again, when I match up Cam Wallace-Kirk and everything that he's good at, when I match up Mirsad Bektic and what he's quite good at, a lot of very similar comparables there. So it does scare you a little bit. Mirsad was a way bigger favorite than Cam Wallace is here. So I do like Cam Wallace for what it's worth in this matchup, taking on Damon Jackson, who is a very, very dangerous guy who was able to win an impressive fight his last time out, where he was bleeding like a faucet out of his eyebrow.
Keo grappled Charles Rosa, though, really bad in that fight, and it did give me a lot of confidence going into this matchup, and I do think that's going to be a big key with Cam Wallace-Kirk. I think Damon Jackson is going to want to grapple early in a lot of these rounds, because if Kirk can just get a takedown with a minute left, he's not going to really have to do a lot with that position to still secure a round, whereas if Jackson can just make sure, okay, we're grappling at minute one of the round, not minute four, it's going to allow him to really burn out the arms of Cam Wallace-Kirk and really start to get him tired as this matchup goes on, and I think that's the big key to this fight. I think Kirk's going to have a really strong start, and I think Jackson's going to have a really strong finish. It just kind of depends on what happens in the middle. I'm going to pick Damon Jackson, though. I do like his experience factor, and Kamwela Kirk, he could completely change my opinion of him because of this fight. Beating Makwan Amirkhani doesn't really prove to me that much, and like you said, did he even really beat him? It was a close fight. Beating Damon Jackson, though, does prove to me that you are a legit UFC talent, so I think it's a huge opportunity for Kirk, although I am going to pick Jackson.
Big time opportunity for both of these guys. We're split on the pick. I've got the Jawaian, Matt's got the Leech, a battle of interesting nicknames. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight, and for the rest of them, because it's a big time fight. Fight Night cards. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
And as it is, the weird, wild MMA career that's been Trevin Jones, the Trevin Jones experience continues on this weekend. Coming up, he's set to take on a welcome to the UFC, the Snow Leopard, Javed Basharat, a very impressive fighter out of London Shoot Fighters, a great Taekwondo background. We'll have a lot to say about Javed Basharat, who was born in Afghanistan, but really got his mojo and gut going over in England. But Matt, when it comes to Trevin Jones, and I set things up that way, before he came into the UFC, what the heck were your impressions of Trevin Jones?
I have some question marks coming into the UFC, because you just didn't really know what you were going to get. You knew he had big power. He did have a salty record, which is always something you have to worry about. But he did kind of prove that he was more, at least early on, in the Vicente Luque category of I have a bad record than of any other example of a guy who just has a bad record fighting a lot of cans. Because Trevin Jones had a UFC debut similar to, like, Chaos Williams, I think it's fair to say. Another guy who, let's be honest, we both weren't entirely sold on. And then he shows up just flatlining people. And that's a great way to get a lot of fans excited. And I'm going to be honest, I don't want to say it was the conductor of the Trevin Jones hype train, but I was saying he was going to go on to have an incredibly successful career. And he still could, but we have seen him falter a little bit as of late.
And this is it. I mean, for Trevin Jones, he's taken on Timur Valiyev. Valiyev was about a minus 600 favorite in that fight. He has a great first round. And then in the second round, he kind of gets caught with that power jab. I guess you could call it like a cross that Jones is able to land. He follows it up, finishes that fight, tested positive for the weed. And so it's a no contest. Now, in Nevada, if I'm not mistaken, you'd still get a win on that one today. But Trevin Jones, it's a no contest on his record. No takesies, backsies. So his next time out, he takes on Mario Bautista. And I thought, hey, Mario's a hell of a fighter. Mario's going to win that fighter. Nope, Trevin Jones flying knee into a knockout. But again, I say weird wild because he's fought for all these different promotions. It's not every day you get a fighter from Guam competing in the UFC. Roky Martinez is one in and around the same time as Jones. But again, like there's a handful of fighters from Guam in the UFC. And then after Bautista, this is the biggest part out of Trevin Jones' career. Look at all the fights that have been scratched. He gets Bautista because he was supposed to fight Randy Costa. Then he's supposed to fight Tony Kelly, who falls out. He's supposed to fight Ronnie Lawrence. He's supposed to fight Mana Martinez. He's supposed to fight Hany Barcelos. He gets cited to Kup Kakrakmanov on short notice. And listen, I think, and we'll talk about the odds as this one goes on, but I think a lot of people, it's one of those like, hey, we really discount you based off your last performance. Trevin Jones looked like he was swimming through mud in his last fight against Kakrakmanov. Couldn't get off the fence, couldn't wrestle defensively, couldn't strike, couldn't initiate his grappling, where the big question mark for me with Jones outside of the UFC, he would get taken down or he would get his back taken. He would get in all these bad positions, but most of the time he would get out and then he would get his own submission. In the fight against Kakrakmanov, A, credit to him, we knew how good he was outside of the UFC. He's shown up in the UFC and looked amazing, but B, Trevin Jones looked so flat that night that it really, really made us kind of wonder, okay, Valiyev, and then his fight against Bautista, were those just lucky shots that he was able to land?
I definitely don't think the Mario Bautista shot was just a lucky shot, and I do think there's a really exciting fighter with Trevin Jones, but I am starting to think that we should put him more into the, like, exciting fight of the night fight category, more than you could be a future champion category, because for Jones, his strengths are very, very apparent. He has phenomenal knockout power. He is a good offensive grappler, although I will admit, defensively, the IQ is sometimes lacking, but You worry about his weaknesses. I don't love his output against a lot of guys. And like you said, against Kakhramonov, he just seemed a step behind and he could never get out of first gear. Couldn't get much going with his striking. Couldn't get any range-finding weapons going. Couldn't get his own wrestling going. It just did leave a lot of question marks moving forward. Because again, I thought Trevin Jones was on that path to, wow, we're going to be at least top 15 and we'll figure out the rest later. But now against Javid, who is such a great striker and who is going to be the bigger guy too. And I do think that really bothered Trevin Jones in his last matchup. Kakhramonov looked like he was three weight classes bigger than him. He was a very big guy for that weight class, or for this weight class, I should say. And I do think that he will run into a very similar issue in this matchup, because if he can't find any of those attacks that help him get into his range, he might just be a sitting duck on the outside. And the problem with Jones is he really needs to get on the inside to be able to deliver a lot of his power. And if he isn't able to get on the inside, like you said, he never has really shown the ability to get a lot off going other than the big moments in his fight.
And for Trevin Jones in that fight against Kakhramonov, who took that fight on short notice, Kakhramonov missed weight at 138. For Javid Basharat, this is where I like to get down and dirty. So we have a very interesting prospect coming into the UFC. And it's always fun when you just click on the page, because if you're on Tapology, number 2, Bantamweight, UK and Ireland. Number 1, Jack Cartwright. Why doesn't he fight more? Why does he shave all of his head, but he leaves that little bit on the back? Your Cage Warriors champion. So for Javid, he's fought for umpteen different promotions in his young MMA career. And when I watch him fight, and I know it's a cheap comparison, but it is true, I look at him and I look at the way that Anthony Pettis is kind of taking some moments off and then throwing really flashy stuff. Javid Basharat will fight like that. He'll throw a spinning wheel kick and then land in a different stance and start throwing some more output. It is a lot of fun. It is a lot of flash and flair. 11-0, 7 different promotions since making his pro debut back in 2016. A lone fight as an amateur. You look at the level of competition. Yeah.
Not good.
All of his wins are by finish. 5 of them by knockout, 6 of them by submission. 8 in the first round, 2 in the second round, 1 in the third round. And if you go back through, yeah, I mean, not the best level of competition. He 45-59, if we really do add it
terrible
up. And if you look at it, the win that he had over Alexander Beskoroviani over with Octagon, his 11-1 was a salt 11-1. It was Windsor salt at its finest. So it really is tricky when you want to look at that, but you have to at least piece together the ways that he's able to win. So I'm going to work from top fight back, but he takes on Oran Kalon over with Contender Series, that one back in October. In that fight, he is a favorite to win it. Now, it says it's at a catchweight. That's because Oran missed weight for that one. And Oran also called him a dirty, dirty name before that fight. And it was the meanest thing ever. You shouldn't do that. Oran showed up at 138 and looked like a bag of milk. And he looked terrible and he couldn't get going. And credit where it's due for Javid, he was really able to get flowing early in that one. He got mean. He ends up getting a third round guillotine choke in that one. Oran was done in that third round, like completely done. He was busted open. The second round, first round, like you could have had some 10-8s in there too. Then you go back to the fight against Alexander Beresklaviani over with Octagon. And again, if we're making some notes, the referee looked like what Keith Peterson's going to look like in 15 years, but with a beard. So kudos to him. There was a point there where Javid gets him down, and he kind of pulls up on his shoulders, goes to land a knee, hits the body, and then the referee goes, whoa, 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 knee to the head, and the corner yells, no, no, it was to the body, and the referee goes, oh, okay, I guess let's just reset this position. Javid's able to go in there. He ends up getting a Darce choke out of it. But if you look at all of these fights, the fight against Nicolas Savio that you can find from Contenders Norwich
29,
that one is over on Fight Plus. So glad I had Fight TV Plus so I could watch that. But in that one, he drops him, gets it down to the mat, and it finishes. The best part about Javid, he switches stances a lot. He's very fluid with that. Moves around, a lot of pitter-patter. And he's like another fighter that we have early on in this card in Azamat Mirzakhanov, and the fact that very light on his feet, knows exactly when to pick his shots, and when he throws in combination, there's a ton of power behind what he's got in his hands.
I think he's going to struggle at the UFC level, if I'm being completely honest, because I do really call into question his level of competition, and that was something that was apparent going back and watching it. Like Jeremiah Wells, I just keep on remembering when we brought this up about him. Go back and watch his fights in the regional scene, and you actually see the level of competition. You're like, wow, those guys are not impressing me whatsoever. Javid has a lot of similarities with that, and I'm really glad you brought up his fight on Octagon, because that was the first thing I was going to say. You might look at his Tapology page and think, wow, he beat a guy who was 11-1. That looks really good. Not at all. That guy did not look good in the the fight whatsoever. And I do think that this is a monumental opportunity for Javid. Like, if he can beat Trevin Jones, who at one point I thought was a borderline top 15 guy, and hey, he might get back to that point in the future. He could look really good this weekend and completely change my opinion. I'm very open to that. But Jones has at least proven to us that his record might not be great, but I'd rather someone not have a great record against a really high level of competition than someone who's just breezed through their whole entire MMA career and never faced adversity once in their whole entire life. It was like my Cyril Gane point, and I thought Volkov made him face enough adversity in their fight, but I was wrong. We saw what happened when he was on the receiving end of a lot of takedowns, and he just didn't know what to do. The moment was almost a little bit too big for him. I'm not saying Javid's going to have big, you know, UFC jitters, and that's why he's going to lose, but I think the step up from fighting Orion to Trevin Jones is going to be a really big wake-up call for him, and I do expect Jones to get a win. Although, this is really important for Trevin Jones' career, too. I cannot understate that. Again, he went from bright prospect, who we do have question marks about, to, wow, this guy really is a good prospect. Now we're left shaking our heads after that Cockrockmano fight. I think this is a really important one for him.
And if you look at it for the man himself, Javid Basharat, two big things for him. I mean, he walked out in that octagon performance to How We Do by 50 Cent. He walked out to the game before that, so what 50 Cent adjacent song like other, could yeah. we get? No, they don't. But and 50 Cent hanging from like his
that
feet
was cool
at the Super Bowl. 50 Cent still doing the damn thing. Chemin du Roi at the old Bellator events. They haven't been doing that lately. But the odds for this fight: Jones open to +150. He's a +125 underdog. Basharat open to -175. He's a -150 right now. And if we have a look at the topology votes, I'm gonna say over under 70% Trevin Jones, the more well known fighter on topology. I would think. And no, the opposite. 524 total votes, 76% Basharat, 28% by decision, 57% by submission. For the 24% that have Jones, 35% by decision, 54% by knockout. Folks,
I'm fine with
I breeze through these fights. I've had a little bit of fun talking about Javid Basharat's last few fights. His fight against Nicolas Savio 2 years ago against a guy who's 2-2 that they brought in from Brazil to lose in England, he missed weight, and then they let him cut the extra weight. He made weight. Couldn't understand what they were saying. That's what the broadcast said. Didn't speak any English. And in that fight, Savio closes distance, hits him with a good combination, and then you have the man himself, yeah, in head and arm position, Javid, able to go in there, look really good. Now, Javid got caught in a couple knee bars on the way in, so suffer for his troubles. Again, in the fight against, and we talked about it, the last one, almost an illegal knee. He gets the win, but it's a padded 11-1. And I go through it. It hasn't been the greatest level of competition. I haven't seen it against the greatest level of guys. I love the leg kick. It stings. It's great. He has one of the better leg kicks of a prospect that I've seen lately. That can cause a guy like Trevin Jones, who can stand back and still have that lead leg out there. He's susceptible to getting kicked. I get it. But I like Trevin Jones in this fight as an underdog. I mean, to me, I love Javid, the prospect. I love the head movement. I love the stance switches. I love the Taekwondo background that he has. I have to see it. So this is a prove-it-to-me fight for Javid. And when I see Trevin Jones, the underdog, I got to go with him here.
I think Trevin Jones is going to finish this fight and look really good. I really do. For Basharat, like, maybe there is a bright future for him out there. But again, based on his body of work, this is a big step up. So maybe he can show me something he hasn't shown yet in his career. But I do like Trevin Jones.
Watch out for it if you're doing the tape study. The fact that when some people start to try and land combinations against Javid, when he's got them pressured, he does the Alistair Overeem where he just kind of cuts, runs away, resets, and figures things back out. So a little bit of a comparable there. But let us know down below in the comments section if you have the man himself making the UFC debut, the Snow Leopard, Javid Basharat, or if you're going with five-star Trevin Jones in the underdog role, a big-time fight, especially for this loaded bantamweight division. We get some big-time fights left on this card, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Pressure versus pressure fight. Coming up this weekend, we have Jillian Robertson coming in on short notice at flyweight, replacing the Queen of Violence, Ariane Lipsky, taking on the boxer, JJ Aldrich. And if there's anything I know about JJ Aldrich, it's that she does not like to throw kicks. She likes to throw hands. She likes to grapple every now and again, but it's mostly on the defensive end of things. Coming out of Elevation Fight Team in Colorado, and we could say oil and water in this fight, but it really is oil and water in this fight. For Jillian Robertson, she knows where her bread gets buttered. It is with her grappling. And she is very powerful when she can implement that game plan. We saw it against Sarah Frota, where she was able to get the TKO win. We saw it in her fight against Molly McCann. She's been able to do that in some of these big-time marquee matchups where she's able to get wins. And for both of these women, coming off the Ultimate Fighter, for Robertson off of Season 26, that was Nico Montano versus Roxanne Modafferi in the final. For JJ Aldrich, coming off of Season 23. But a lot of experience out of these two in the UFC. I mean, we see it for Robertson, 7-4, the UFC record. JJ Aldrich, not out there as often, and she's been in the UFC for longer at 6-3. But Matt, again, it really is a tale of striker versus grappler in this one. And on short notice, it's interesting for Robertson because she was originally in Vegas to corner a former foe, now friend, in Hannah Goldie a few weeks ago. Goldie unable to make the walk. Dean Thomas is already there doing a little bit of that commentary work for the UFC. So an interesting one for Robertson to just get a fight in and take on JJ Aldrich.
If you put Clay Guida into a machine and you cut his fighting style in half, like directly down the middle, it would create Jillian Robertson and JJ Aldrich. Because like you set this video up with, both these fighters do like to pressure, something Clay Guida is known for. But they pressure in very different ways. Robertson's someone who really uses the threat of the takedown and her takedowns, of course, to pressure opponent up against the cage, use some, let's just call it what it is, basic boxing combinations, and then get the fight down to the mat, where she does have very nice jiu-jitsu, especially offensively. Whereas with Aldrich, always moving forward, really likes to put the jab out there, really good boxer, but she does fight kind of like an Ally Quinta, to where we know she has wrestling, but she primarily uses it defensively in most of her matchups. And this is an interesting fight, because with Robertson, she was a very hyped up prospect at one point. People put her in the same category of like a Macy Barber. And then we had one of those great prospect versus prospect fights. And what happened in that fight, Craig?
She got knocked out.
Very, very fast, too. And when I try to see, okay, what's Jillian Robertson going to do and how she fights JJ Aldrich? Aldrich fights a lot like Macy Barber. Yes, she might not go for as many offensive takedowns of her own, but she has good boxing for this division. I would say she has underrated power in this division too, and her takedown defense is good enough against most people who don't have a very high level wrestling background to at least keep the fight on the feet. And is Aldrich going to go out there and outstrike everyone in the division? No, of course not. Like, let's say Marina Rodriguez like had another one-off at Flyweight. I don't know why she came to mind, but you get the idea. Technically, someone like Rodriguez is much more high level than Aldrich, but Aldrich is almost built to beat fighters like Jillian Robertson. Fighters who rely on their takedowns, although they aren't the best wrestlers in the world, have really good jiu-jitsu, but it's not often we can see it just because the wrestling isn't a strength. And then on the feet, I don't think Robertson can throw combos or really much with JJ Aldrich in this matchup. So for me, I think it'll be interesting to see how does Robertson win moments and win minutes in this fight.
I mean, for Robertson, 11 fights in the UFC, she's only had two of those 11 where she wasn't able to gain a takedown. The one against Macy Barber where she gets finished on the feet. The other one against future title challenger, your next title challenger, Ty Los Santos. And if you look at it for Aldrich, in her losses, she does get out-grappled in her UFC debut, and I think that's a big one to really point to. Now, that was years ago when she had that fight coming off of The Ultimate Fighter, taking on Juliana Lima, who was able to implement her grappling, wins over Chanmi Jun, Danielle Taylor, Pollyanna Viana. She gets finished by Macy Barber, a win over Lauren Mueller, the loss to Sabina Mazo by split, a win over Courtney Casey by split. You can make a decision either way for sure in that one. And then the win over Vanessa Demopoulos, where Vanessa had some good moments in the first round.
Vanessa's not a UFC caliber fighter.
But that's it. I think she is a strawweight, but we can differ on that one. But here and now, up at 125 pounds, I'm going to read you the odds. We accidentally brought the Tapology votes up. But the odds for this one, Robertson on short notice, minus 160 at open, minus 155 right now. Aldrich at open, plus 140, plus 128 right now. Tapology votes, 429 of them. 74% going with Robertson, 63% by submission. For the 26% that have Aldrich, 87% by decision. For Jillian Robertson, this one's on short notice, but she's fresh. She doesn't have to cut a lot of weight from what I heard in an interview with friend of the show, Lucas Grandsire, that I just listened to. She talks about, you know, the fact that she knows a striker versus grappler. But when I looked at the gyms, she used to be at ATT, right? And then from Instagram, from her last fight where she was able to get the win, she is trained at Indoor Martial Arts, Fusion XL, Extreme Couture, the Goat Shed Academy, Glory MMA and Fitness, and 10th Planet Vegas while she's been in Vegas right now for the last few weeks, obviously getting ready for Goldie and her fight, and then, you know, now this fight. It seems like the Goat Shed Academy has kind of been, you know, the mainstay at least.
They don't have an Instagram page, though, and that's weird.
They do. It's just like, it seems like it's a broken link. But yeah, it is kind of weird that way. But they do have a website if you're looking for it, and they're on Facebook. But when it comes to this matchup, yeah, Robertson's kind of bounced around. Dean Thomas is there as corner for the advice. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of the fight, Robertson needs to take down. Aldrich has to defend it. And Aldrich, you're right. She has decent takedown defense in the UFC. It's not like the best we've ever seen. It's not the worst.
It's intelligent takedown defense, though. She knows what the basics are. Dig underhooks, get my back off the cage. And as long as you know the basics, I do think that's good enough to beat someone like Robertson, who, again, her jiu-jitsu is very good, but her wrestling kind of lacks the transition between her striking and her jiu-jitsu. And unless you have the striking of someone like Brian Ortega, it's really hard to go into a cage relying on your world-class jiu-jitsu and just average wrestling, if you will. So I do think if Robertson does get this fight to the mat, especially early, she can have a lot of success. I just worry about, other than a submission finish, how is she going to be able to win rounds consistently? Because Aldrich has a decent work rate, does work behind the jab, and it's just kind of frustrating on the feet. And I do think Robertson, if she does shoot for a lot of takedowns, is going to be forced to shoot from a very long distance in this fight, which is just going to hurt her percentages a little bit worse on those takedown attempts. So I do like Aldrich in this matchup.
Craziest part about it for Aldrich, I open it up saying this, she does not throw leg kicks. The only fight she threw leg kicks in was the Chan Mi-Jun fight, but these are the averages. 0%, 20%, 3%, 2%, 4%, 6%, 0%, 1% of total strikes to the legs. Like, she does not throw kicks, but she throws a nice jab and can follow it up with a nice one too.
And I know I've been gassing up JJ Aldrich, but this does have to be said. She's only really fought UFC entry level talent in her whole entire UFC career. That's not a great sign. Like, by this point, you would like to see her start fighting people up the rankings a little bit, and not even ranked fighters when I say that, just people with a little bit more respect tied to their name. Because when you're 9 fights deep in the UFC and you're still fighting the likes of Vanessa Demopoulos, we expect a little bit more out of you, and I do think this fight is that opportunity for her.
Big opportunity for both of those women. I'm sure we'll hear it in the comments section for not siding with the Canadian in this one, but both of us going with the boxing of JJ Aldrich to get it done. You let us know if we're wrong down there. You let us know if we're right. That one doesn't happen very often, but it should be a big time fight, and we got a big time card coming up. Alex Pereira's taking on Bruno Silva. You know I'm excited about it. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Interesting fight. Coming up this weekend, we have the UFC debut of Lafayette, Louisiana zone. It's the ghost AJ Fletcher, guy who does happen to train with Dustin Poirier and Alan Joban. And he's looking to put that shiny, squeaky 9-0 perfect record on the line against the guy in Matt Semelsberger, Semi the Jedi, coming in here at 9-3 with a little bit more experience. But you know what he does have? A 15-second and a 16-second knockout win, respectively, in the UFC. You don't see that very often. Wins over Jason Witt, and then his last time out, a win over Nick Diaz training partner Martin Sanoh. A big-time win there, not that long ago, about 4 months ago. A loss on his record to Chaos Williams that was really a 50-50 fight in that one. And then before, I went over Carlton Minus in his UFC debut. So kind of weird that they match up a guy off a contender series against a guy who's already 3-1 with a promotion. But that is what we're getting in this matchup. For AJ Fletcher, he's a guy that even the broadcast in his fight on Dana White's contender series against Damiani, they kind of mentioned, hey, this guy looks a little small for this division. You look at it, he kind of has a Sean Sherk build for 170 pounds. He really is at a reach disadvantage. You see that in terms of the numbers. What is it, like an 8-inch reach disadvantage? And Paul Felder even said on the broadcast, they list him as 5'10", same height as his opponent. He's not as tall as his opponent whatsoever. So I'd like to get the real particulars on Fletcher. There's a fluffer on board somewhere with some of those reaches and the heights. But when it comes to AJ Fletcher, he uses his size well in his fights.
Fights way bigger than he is. And I'm not just counting out the hops that he had in his last fight, because he did jump to the moon on that flying knee. And it was very, very nice. This should be a really fun fight. I do believe it will be. Because like you said, Semelsberger's the more experienced guy, but just his fighting style is going to give AJ Fletcher a chance to win this fight, because both guys are known for their tremendous knockout ability, and that's why I'm so excited for this fight. And for Fletcher, this is a great opportunity to get a really big statement win in your UFC debut. Not that Semelsberger is a big name by any means, but because he does leave windows open with his striking style, Fletcher could leave this win either getting a big poster dunk or being on the receiving end of one, which could always be good or bad for your UFC debut. But I just think this is a fun fight to get things started off on, because for Semelsberger, we know the type of power he has. You set it off. 2 sub-20 second KOs in the UFC is absolutely ridiculous. But again, he's one of these power punchers who can kind of fall into a lull sometimes in his fights. But that's going to be the really fun thing about this one. AJ Fletcher does not give you the opportunity to ever have range and just sort of take a breath in your fight. Fletcher's going to be face to face with you just trying to land his own power shots. And yes, does he sometimes aim pretty big and miss pretty big as a result of it? Yes, he does quite often. But when he is able to land those big shots, they have devastating effects.
And before he took on Damiani over on Contender Series, who was 10-2-1, before that, AJ Fletcher's level competition, he was 8-0, 40-55, so it wasn't the greatest. And again, I went back and did a lot of tape study on AJ Fletcher, and it just kind of continues to confirm that. The fight against Ariel Juarez, where he's able to go out there and get the submission, Juarez is starting to land a combination up against the cage. It's the ability to get the fight down to the mat by Fletcher. And the thing that I love out of him, it's the fact that he's got a really nice kick to the leg. And he really does whip it out there well and try and kind of figure out his distance. He figures it out fairly early in his fights. You do see a lot of first-round finishes or early enough finishes. At least his last three have been in the first round for Fletcher. His fight against Wesley Golden, he just kind of lands a big overhand right, drops Golden, ends up on top, and he ends up getting the submission pretty quick in that one as well. But he really is an all-action type of fighter. I listened to another interview with Lucas Grandsire, and he kind of talked about the fact that it's been hard to get fights after winning on Contender Series. It hasn't been injuries. He hasn't fought since August of last year. So, bit of a layoff for him coming into this fight. He was kind of surprised that he ended up with a guy that's 3-1, but really accepting of this matchup. Like, hey, they're throwing me into the deep end. I like that. So, I like that as well. Might seem like a surprise that you kind of expect like a little bit of a layup for a guy that's exciting as AJ Fletcher. You want him to get his feet wet and for him to get a win. But it is an interesting one because for Fletcher, doesn't come into MMA with some extensive background in wrestling, no big high school state champion, but that can be a staple of his game as well. Really good double legs, really good single legs too.
Do you know what I think the career of AJ Fletcher is going to be like? Nate Landwehr's. It's going to be fun sometimes. There's going to be some highs. There's definitely going to be some lows. Just being that aggressive with your fighting style is going to cost you at some points. And yes, you can see the positives throughout his record. Like you said, he can drop guys into submissions. He can knock them out outright on the feet. Like, he does look very good against this low level of competition, which is what we say. If you're fighting guys who aren't on your level, you better look good doing it. And you better do it in impressive fashion. I just worry about what he's going to look like against Semelsberger if that first flurry doesn't land. If Semelsberger does weather that early storm, which he can, like, he fought Chaos Williams to what was a fairly competitive fight, and Chaos Williams has legit knockout power. And listen, AJ Fletcher hits hard, but I don't think he's the knockout artist Chaos Williams is by any means. So I do think that Semelsberger, like you said, he's got the experience factor, and not only does he just have the experience factor, he's fought guys that uniquely get him ready for this matchup, and I do think that's going to be a big key to this fight.
And when you look at this one for Semelsberger, the one giant negative that I have is the fact that his wrestling defense can be shoddy at times.
Sucks.
Now, his offense is quite good. I mean, both of these guys, for AJ Fletcher, you might not think it, but he was a middle linebacker in football. He wanted to go to college for football. It didn't work out, so he found MMA. For Matt Semelsberger, oh, the college football found him. He was a strong safety, and I'll throw the picture up there. Like, he looks like the caveman from Geico got
like
an opportunity
it.
On the team, but 204 pounds, and they say he was even higher than that when he was playing.
Big
as
guy.
A freaking 204-pound strong safety. You imagine that guy coming at you looking to tackle you if you're a wide receiver?
Terrifying.
No way, Jose, but he ends up in MMA. Again, the big fight that I point to for Matt Semelsberger that gives me pause is the fight that he had way back when, and it's a win, too, with CFFC against Ken Chenbekov, where he wins by split decision, but he gives up minutes off his back, and he was holding guard, like wrapping his legs. You didn't like to see it, but he has definitely grown as things have gone on. Crazy 88 MMA has been the home for him for a very long time. Gladiators Academy of Lafayette for AJ Fletcher. But I look at the odds in this one. Semelsberger open to -205, -253 right now. For Fletcher, open to +175. And he is up around a +201 or thereabouts on best fight odds. We look at Tapology for the votes. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Semelsberger.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. They are over 474 total votes, 79% Semelsberger, 71% by knockout. For the 21% that have Fletcher, it's like a lifesaver popsicle, 33% by decision, 28% submission, 30% by knockout. Those numbers don't add up to 100, so sometimes Tapology, the math isn't there. But what I do know is the fans are favoring Semelsberger. The odds favor Semelsberger. But Fletcher, I like his wrestling and I like his power in this one too.
I just think he has so many windows of opportunity for someone to knock him out. And that's the thing. I don't really like the odds on this fight because Semelsberger will play Fletcher's game, especially early. He will trade a lot of those power shots, which will leave a door open for AJ Fletcher to win. But I do think Semelsberger is the steadier guy throughout this fight. And I do think that offensively, he's going to be the one to go to his wrestling first. And I do think that's going to be a big factor. I do think that if push comes to shove and he really needs it, especially up close, he can really go for it if he has to. Whereas I do think Fletcher's going to struggle a little bit more to get the takedown offensively if he needs it. So for that reason, I'll pick Semelsberger, although I am surprised to see him be such a big favorite.
Semelsberger, I think he just gets the respect from those really quick knockouts of Witt and of Sanoa's last time out. But when I look at Semelsberger, good offensive wrestling, not good defensive wrestling. I don't necessarily know if I see him shooting first. I'm eager to see these guys on Friday because I assume Matt Semelsberger is going to look a weight class bigger than AJ Fletcher. Fletcher's bodied up, but Semelsberger is a really big guy. He rehydrates big. He also throws big time straight shots down the pipe. The one thing that I don't like out of Semelsberger is he's not a volume guy at all. And even when he wasn't knocking guys out like big time on the regional scene, it's a lot of one, reset, one, two, reset. And then we wait and we wait and we wait. And you don't like to see those periods against a guy in Fletcher that I've seen him get hit big time straight down the middle. And when he does, he reacts and then he wrestles and it works to great effects in those fights. But for me, I do like Semelsberger. I like the straight shots. I like the power. I love AJ Fletcher as a prospect, but for me, I just can't take him in this matchup here.
Here for a good time, not a long time. I think that could be the career of AJ Fletcher. I think he's going to be a contender to win fight of the night every time he's on a card. I'm just curious to see how much success he'll have at the UFC level.
Big time opportunity for both of these guys. Let us know if you're going with the Ghost, Fletcher, or Semi the Jedi, Matt Semelsberger. We both have him. And a big time card coming up. Pereira taking on Silva in the main event. Santos taking on Ankalaev. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Some sort of bonus is incoming at middleweight. We have a big-time marquee matchup on the main card between Alex Pereira taking on the former middleweight champ with M1 Global in Bruno Silva, a guy who's no stranger to performance bonuses. Last time out, he gets hit a couple times there by Jordan Wright and some big time kicks to the body and the head. He withstands the pressure and he lands a crazy combination following him across the cage. His time before that, Andrew Sanchez takes him down 7 times in the third round. He says, we're not doing this anymore. I'm putting you out, pal, and sending you outside of the UFC. So for Bruno Silva, it's been an amazing run. He hasn't lost a fight in years. And he took a few years to compete inside the UFC due to a USADA suspension for Boldenone, but he's cleared, he's past that, and he's winning in the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And for Alex Pereira, what more can I say? I mean, Joe Rogan sung his praises on the JRE experience. Then he ends up in the UFC. Joe's calling his fight. He's singing his praises.
Wouldn't the JRE experience be the Joe Rogan experience?
I don't know. I don't pay attention to the show.
No, E stands for experience, I believe.
We don't have to pick on that. I'm fired up about this fight, Matt. Don't get hung up on meaningless details. But what we do know is for Alex, this guy was the first ever simultaneous multi-weight champion with Glory Kickboxing. Middleweight champ, interim light heavy. Heavyweight champ, light heavyweight champ. We don't have to talk about the part where he lost his belt.
Close fight though, so.
A couple months before he made his UFC debut. But what we can talk about is the fact that he came into his fight against Andreas Mihailidis with a ton of hype. It was a featured prelim to a pay-per-view. Some surprised that it wasn't on the main card. And in that, Mihailidis is a guy with some kickboxing acumen in his back pocket, but he is known for his grappling. And in the first round, 3-7 on his takedown attempts. He won that first round handily. He was like, I don't know, butter on a roll in that first round. He really did have a great job with his grappling. Then the commentary team kind of focuses on it. There's a big amount of swelling on Mihailidis' left eye as he comes into the second round. Pereira goes, throws a head kick out there. It's blocked. And then he goes jumping switch knee and knocks him out cold. So a giant win for Pereira, a performance bonus for him to his last time out. But for both of these guys, Silva actually has some grappling and jiu-jitsu in his back pocket. But again, we talk about bread getting buttered. It's also with the striking. These two guys with some of the biggest power in this division. I love this matchup.
When Seth Petruzzelli fought Kimbo Slice, it produced one of the greatest soundbites of all time from Dana White. Because allegedly, Seth Petruzzelli was offered money not to take Kimbo Slice down. And you know what Dana White said in response to that? That's f***ing illegal. Now, I'm here to offer a very similar type of rule set for this matchup. I think the first person who shoots for a takedown should be immediately cut for the UFC. I think this is as close to a pure kickboxing fight as we've ever gotten in the UFC. And you're right, Bruno Silva is probably the better grappler out of these guys, but I do not expect him to shoot for a takedown at all in this matchup. And if he does shoot for a takedown, it's because he got cracked by a huge shot in the feet, and he's probably well on his way out of the fight. I really do expect this to just be a striking battle between these two guys, and I'm going to offer maybe a hot take, maybe not really, because Bruno Silva does have 20 knockouts in MMA, but I do think Silva's oddly the more dangerous guy, just strike for strike in this matchup, especially on the feet, because with Pereira, he does set up his knockout strikes way better than Bruno Silva, and I'm not saying this is a knock against Pereira by any means. This is a massive, massive compliment to him. He's such an intelligent striker that he doesn't go in there knowing, hey, I have 4-ounce gloves, if I just swing hard enough, if I hit them, they're gonna fall. He's much more intelligent than just a power heavy striker. Whereas Bruno Silva, he is a good boxer, but he can be gloated into a brawl sometimes. And you do see him. He just sees red either when he gets hit by a big shot or when he hurts his opponent with a big shot. And that can be great. Like, you don't have as many finishes as he has and not be a great finisher. But he does leave himself open sometimes when he does go for those big finishes. And against guys like Jordan Wright, yes, you can get over aggressive and really go for that finish. But against someone like Alex Pereira, who's so good at moving on the feet in the middle of the cage, even up against the cage, it's going to be really curious to see, where does Bruno Silva feel comfortable throwing strikes with Alex Pereira? Do you think it's going to be in the middle of the cage, or do you think we're actually going to see some clinch work out of Bruno Silva to get the fight close, maybe get Pereira up against the cage to then use some of those boxing combos?
From seeing Bruno Silva on Instagram, again, depends on how much stock you put into it, but he's always training his boxing, always, at Evolução Thai MMA down in Brazil, so I would expect to beat Alex Pereira. You look at his record, and obviously his one loss in MMA is by submission years ago, and it is what it is, but he's going to have that. That's the spot of his game that a lot of people are going to try and exploit. Now, you like to see the fact that Pereira has aligned himself with Teixeira MMA and Fitness in Connecticut. I wonder, you know, the population of Brazilians that have moved to Connecticut in not even the last 10 years, but like the last 5 years. And now you get a 42-year-old champion up a weight class in Glover Teixeira. Like, it's just crazy to see the amount of people that have started to go through that gym lately, and you like to see it for Glover. You feel good for him.
100%. Like, Glover, I can't not smile when I look at Glover Teixeira. He's in his 40s, living his best life, a UFC champion after everybody wrote him off. Now he has, let's be honest, like a fairly successful gym kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's just nice to see the overall career progression of Glover. But I agree with you. Having a guy like that training with you all the time, when your one weakness in your game is the takedown defense and the overall grappling, I don't know if you know this, Craig, Glover Teixeira is a pretty darn good grappler, so if you do train with him every day, it's going to help you upgrade that part of your game really fast.
But no, I would expect the man himself, Bruno Silva, to go out there to try and at least take the fight to the mat, make it ugly up against the cage in the clinch. Now, the opposite can be said. Like, when Jordan Wright was taking on Bruno Silva, he was the one that actually initiated the clinch, and then he was the one that on his way back, he likes to leave his head nice and high and got hit by a couple hooks, rocked all the way back, the fight's over. But I look at it again, for Pereira, 33-7 in kickboxing, 21 knockouts, we talk about the title, so on and so forth. The odds for this one, Pereira opened around a minus 170, still about there. For Bruno Silva, plus 145. We have a look at the Topology boat. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say 75% over-under for Pereira in this one.
I would say over.
Ooh, it's close. 594 total votes, 74% Pereira, 84% by knockout. For the 26% that have Silva, 74% by knockout. I think we're going to get a knockout in this one as well. Bruno Silva could submit him, so I guess I'm a little bit surprised that there aren't more there. Now I know, Bruno Silva, you look at his record, not a lot of submissions there, but he definitely has the better ground game out of these two guys.
It is hard to expect a guy, though, at 32 years of age who's never really gone for a lot of submissions in his career to all of a sudden turn that on.
That's it, and I look at this one, you know, Alex Pereira, he's 4-1 in MMA, he's 34, but the miles are there from kickboxing. He has 4 inches of height. He has 6 inches of reach against Silva. Like, it's just crazy to see that in a fight like this. And Bruno Silva's a guy, that marches forward into damage. Alex Pereira is one of the most dynamic strikers you're going to find out there from either side. It sucks because Bruno Silva's a guy that I championed at M1 to come into the UFC. I've got Alex Pereira in this fight.
I'm going to try to say this in the nicest way possible. This is the easiest fight for Alex Pereira in the UFC, who's still a tough opponent for him. Because Bruno Silva stylistically does everything Alex Pereira does. There's not that much that he does that's outside of the skill set of Alex Pereira. Yes, he's the better grappler of the two, but that's only because Pereira, up until like 6 months ago, probably never really cared about grappling because he was just a pure kickboxer for the most part. So I don't think that Silva's going to all of a sudden come in and start wrestling a lot. I don't expect us to see the grappling side of his game. And here's the other thing. Silva's not much of a kicker. He really does need to get into boxing range. Alex Pereira can strike moving forwards, moving backwards, and he's a kick-heavy fighter. I really do think he's going to march through Bruno Silva.
Big-time opportunity for both of these guys at middleweight. I know I'm going to be sitting back regardless of odds or anything with pop and maybe beer, popcorn. Like, it's going to be an event. I'm going to have everybody over my giant jug of water. It's going to be a spectacle to behold. I'm fired the F up for this fight. Alex Pereira taking on Bruno Silva. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this all-important fight in the middleweight division. It's a big-time one and a big-time main card to boot. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. The shortest of short notice fight coming up this weekend. We have T-Rex Terrence McKinney, like summer jean short, an 8 days notice replacing one really tricky out in this one. I'm talking about Tricky Ricky Glenn. And now he's going to be taking on Drew Dober. If you look at it for Terrence McKinney, a big time win. Another statement win over Farah Ziem not that long ago. Just a few weeks ago. And in that fight, Ziem opens up, goes leg kick. McKinney kind of stumbles into it. Ends up just kind of basing, I guess. Ziem decides, hey, let's take this fight to the mat. McKinney bucks him in the scramble, ends up on top, and out of all of the grappling, McKinney ends up sinking in the rear naked choke in the first round. And if you know anything about Terrence McKinney, it's not just flashy knockouts, the Matt Frivola knockout that he had in his UFC debut. You talk about bread getting buttered. For Terrence McKinney, it is with his wrestling. This is a guy that they talked about it a little bit on the broadcast the last time out. He was an Olympic hopeful for wrestling, but I did a little bit more of the deep dive. He was a former FILA All-American as a freshman with North Idaho College, a two-time state champion in high school wrestling. And for McKinney, we even mentioned it in his last loss against Derek Minner on the regional scene with MCF in Nebraska, North Butte's own. He was able to go in there, try and go for the takedown early. Minner catches him, ends up submitting him in that fight. But what McKinney's done since then, he's refined his striking enough to where it is that flashy style that you know out of his game. And for him, he's coming in with a full head of steam, that win streak to boot, and looking like an impressive prospect. And now all of a sudden, he gets to really jump the line against a Drew Dober who, not that long ago, fight of the night against Brad Riddell. He had a fight against Islam Makhachev, future champ. Like, Drew Dober, it might surprise some people, 17 fights in the UFC. He's been around the block for a very, very long time, coming over from Strikeforce. I mean, for Drew Dober, yeah, the record, 23-11 with a no contest, but surprisingly still a young enough guy in this division, and he has that quality of opponent on his record. So for Dober, you're going from Ricky Glenn, who really poses a lot of different threats to you, I guess you could say. Like Ricky Glenn, fairly well-rounded, really finished old Gavin Tucker in impressive fashion that fight years ago. But it is definitely a big difference stylistically going from Glenn to Terrence McKinney for Drew Dober.
It is, because Terrence McKinney's like Rick Glenn with worse volume and just a lot more power. But they are both very well-rounded fighters. And again, Rick Glenn and McKinney aren't that much alike. You get the idea. They both pose threats on the feet and on the mat. For Drew Dober, though, I'm curious to get your take, because again, I hate saying, oh, I thought he won his last fight. I thought he had a good argument of winning the Brad Riddell fight, to be completely honest. That was a very back and forth fight, and one where he dropped Riddell early on, and had Riddell hurt on the feet on multiple different opportunities. So I will be very surprised to see when Terrence McKinney decides to wrestle in this matchup, because McKinney, up until this point, has never faced any adversity in his MMA career, at least at the UFC level, against very, very top-level fighters. We saw him go in there and knock out Matt Frivola quick. The fight against Farah Ziem was quite fast too, and let's be honest, there's still some question marks around Farah Ziem. I don't really think beating him means, wow, you're all of a sudden ready for Drew Dober. But that's the thing about McKinney. This is a huge opportunity from going to Fariseum, just a guy in the division outside the rankings, to Drew Dober, who's known for being able to have fight of the night contending fights with just about anybody in the rankings. And yes, he might not win against everybody with a number next to their name, but very few people just go in there and run over Drew Dober. I know Islam Makhachev did it, but like you said, he quite possibly will be the future champion, and he's beaten everybody very, very easily throughout his UFC tenure. So for Dober, I think this is a good opportunity because, like you said, a fight over Rick Glenn, it's a fun fight, it's one we get excited for, but it doesn't do that much for Drew Dober in the grand scheme
either
of things.
Either guy, really. Glenn more so than
Glenn,
Dober.
I think for Glenn it does quite a bit, whereas with Terrence McKinney, he's taking this on short notice, but this does a lot more for the career of Drew Dober if he's able to beat McKinney, who has a ton of hype behind him. He's very big on social media too, which always helps get eyes onto your own career if you're able to beat him. So I actually think, oddly enough, this is a great chance for Drew Dober, who I would have heavily favored him against Rick Glenn, if we're all being honest. I think he would have beat Glenn quite comfortably. But in this matchup against McKinney, now you're fighting a guy who wasn't preparing for you at all. He has to take this fight on short notice, and stylistically it is kind of similar to the last fight you were getting ready for, so I feel like for Drew Dober, he got not best case scenario out of all this, but this is a great opportunity on short notice for him to take.
And for Drew Dober, you look at some of his best performances, and some of those are fairly recent. I mean, yes. I look at it, the fight, he's got two fight of the nights in his UFC career, one against Frank Camacho, who I saw have a fight booked. I was kind of surprised by that one. The fight of the night against Brad Riddell, who in that fight, we build it as striker versus striker. Drew Dober hits Riddell and rocks him. And then Brad Riddell out-wrestles Drew Dober and takes him down. Like, it was kind of crazy to see that. Performance bonuses over Nasrat Haqparast and Alexander Hernandez, which is kind of odd because they're training partners. So, neat to see it that way. But for Drew Dober, again, those, his last two wins, the fight against Hernandez almost 2 years ago, the fight against Haqparast, well, almost 2 years ago. And then a knockout before that of Polo Reyes, who was a very 50-50 fighter in the UFC. But we look at the losses for Drew Dober. That's really the thing. I mean, you go way back. Will Brooks, way back in 2012. A great wrestler, if he's anything. Sean Spencer. I know. Nick Hine, who was able to out-wrestle him. Leandro Silva, the no contest. Efrain Escudero, who submits him really quickly. Olivier Aubin-Mercier, wrestler. Benil Dariush is up at the top. Like, it's just been a weird mixed bag for Drew Dober, who's really been like a 25 to 15 guy for the longest time. And when he's gotten those top-level guys, it just hasn't necessarily worked out. But a giant opportunity for him. Whereas for Terrence McKinney, he's beating Sean Woodson in their fight on Contender Series, and then he ends up getting finished. He goes in to take down Derek Minner, and then he ends up getting submitted. Now he's on a tidy little win streak. So Matt, when we look at the odds for this one, Dober opened a minus 150. He's minus 225 right now. For Terrence McKinney, opened a plus 130, plus 180. I would expect for Drew Dober at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say Dober over under 75%.
A little bit under, but he should be the favorite.
He is. Oh, no, whoa. 276 total votes. Again, 8 days notice, and we're filming this on Sunday. 68% with McKinney, 20% by decision, 24% by submission, 52% by knockout. For the 32% that have Dober, 44% by decision, 49% by knockout. I think there's some recency bias at play there.
I think McKinney's really going to struggle on the feet with Drew Dober. The way I look at this fight is, if McKinney has success, he has to use his wrestling, because that was the story for the longest time with Dober. It was, hey, on the feet, he can be competitive. He can eat five shots to give one, but you cannot wrestle him. The thing about McKinney, though, is I've seen him out grapple Fariseum, but I do think he's going to at least rely on his striking early on in this matchup, and I think he could get caught in those early exchanges. I actually really like Drew Dober in this matchup, and I know I'm not one to pick people on short notice anyways. I do think that's really a big red flag. But the way I look at this is, the best version of Terrence McKinney might have a 50-50 chance of beating Drew Dober. He's taking this on a little over a week's notice. You have to game plan, get yourself ready, cut the weight, get everything 100% for him to have that 50-50 chance. That's why I like Drew Dober in this matchup. And I don't look at Dober's wrestling as a massive liability either. I think he can defend some of the takedown attempts, especially as the fight progresses. I think this will be a great fight. I don't think a single fan's going to be booing this while it's happening, but I do like Drew Dober.
To me, I look at it, Drew Dober, by the same token, I mean, you're getting ready for a guy in Ricky Glenn that has a pretty good ground game, has a really good striking game. Obviously, that's probably the best part of it. When you do look at it, he was a guy that spent a lot of time at Team Alpha Male, but he's gone back to Iowa, back to his roots, Ricky Glenn, and hopefully he's able to come back, you know, injury-free in the not-so-distant future, because I love a Ricky Glenn fight. But when I look at this one, Dober's massive liability is that takedown defense. It really is. When he loses fights, he's getting taken down, and it's rinse and repeat. Terrence McKinney is so good with the takedowns, not just against Farisiem.
Since Alexander Hernandez, though, and he got lit on fire.
But Alexander Hernandez, as we know, the 50-50 of that top 25, if you want to call it that way. So we've seen these short-notice fights really blow up in the face of some of these fighters. Renato Moicano's fifth round against Dos Anjos was a pleasant surprise because I was surprised they didn't throw the towel in. But for Moicano, man, he gained some fans and a lot of respect with that fight. He didn't come out on their winning end. Islam Makhachev, Bobby Green, that's another one on incredibly short notice. Again, so you look at this one on 8 days' notice.
Too.
I'm still going with Terrence McKinney, especially that big of an underdog. He has such an X factor with his wrestling. I think he'll be able to get it done against Dober, but Drew Dober has been able to turn away prospects like Hernandez, like Hawk Pross as well, in impressive fashion not that long ago. The blueprint's there for Drew Dober.
I'm going to say this, though. Terrence McKinney may have been an Olympic hopeful for wrestling. Chael Sonnen was an Olympic hopeful for boxing, and he is an awful boxer in MMA. Olympic hopeful doesn't mean that much, although McKinney is a very, very good wrestler. I just think he is going to struggle going for a lot of those takedown attempts, and I think on the feet, the overall volume and combination of power that Dober offers is very unique for this division, so I think he'll be able to eat whatever power shots McKinney throws at him. I think he will be able to defend the takedown attempts at least early and get quite a bit of damage off on McKinney.
Big time opportunity for both of these guys on the incredible short notice. Split on the pick, I'm going with T-Rex, Terrence McKinney. Matt going with Drew Dober, the year over year 17 fight UFC veteran. Crazy that we're at that point this far in his career, and a big time main card coming up that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Interesting fight coming up this weekend at light heavyweight. We have the Ultimate Fighter finale runner-up, we could call him that, in Khalil Roundtree Jr., the Warhorse, taking on Baby K, Carl Robertson, in a very interesting fight, and I have a hard time kind of coming up with this one. It's a weird fight. For Carl Robertson, you look at it, he's been a middleweight traditionally, he's had some fights at light heavyweight, he's bounced around, he's had a myriad of fights booked and that have fallen out. He's had weight cuts that have gone bad. It's been a weird mixed bag for Robertson. So let's go through his UFC career really quickly. Beats Ryan Spann with the old elbows over on Dana White's Contender Series. Beats Darren Stewart by rear naked choke, which is a bit of a surprise to some people, because for Carl Robertson, he is a kickboxer. But when he fights in MMA, he tends to grapple.
We've been talking about this for 4 years.
It's the strangest thing. It's like that main law thing that they used to do on Saturday Night Live all the time. But I look at it, lose to Cesar Fajeda by submission. Mutante beats Jack Marshman, lose to Glover Teixeira, beats Wellington Turman, beats Roman Kopylov. Three fights booked and that fell out until he gets Marvin Vettori, the bad blood, the jawing in the hotel lobbies. He ends up losing that one. And then he loses to Brendan Allen his last time out. He's booked against Nick Maximov back in, the fall, late summer, early fall. Robertson withdraws. Now he gets Khalil Roundtree. And for Khalil Roundtree, it's the same way with his career. Not necessarily fights booked that have fallen out, though there have been some of those, but it's just been wins and losses peppered all the way through. He ends up at the end of the season, 23 of The Ultimate Fighter, lose to Andrew Sanchez in the finale, lose to Tyson Pedro. Some wins, some losses peppered in through. The craziest part about this one to me, Matt, is the fact that these guys have 19 combined UFC fights. Only one bonus between the two of them. That one to Khalil Roundtree when he's able to finish Gokhan Saki in the first round of their fight. He also picked up a nice win over Modestus Bukauskas his last time out, where those oblique kicks, they work.
It was kind of, I hate to say it like this, but it was kind of awesome what he did. Like, you don't see that technique often, and it is terrible because it basically always results in, like, a life and career-altering injury. But if a guy is standing at you with a karate stance, and if he is on that front leg with all of his weight on it, and if you're pretty good at throwing oblique kicks, you might as well stomp on it, and that's what Roundtree did. Now, hopefully Bukauskas can heal up and get back to, you know, as close to 100% as possible, but it did show ever-evolving fight IQ from Roundtree, because that is the big knock against him. Like, go back to the Prakniaw fight. Hurts him every time he hits him, and then just doesn't throw any volume, and just sort of lets Prakniaw get back into that fight. That's what's going to be so interesting about this fight, because for me, Roundtree really relies on his opponent making mistakes, and then him capitalizing on them. Whereas Robertson can just go in there, strike and flow with his strikes in the middle of the cage, because if you're not a takedown threat on Carl Roberson, he doesn't really have to worry about, oh, should I be hesitant on the feet? He can really let his kicks go. He can really let his hands go. I do worry about him and his size at light heavyweight, because he has had quite a few problems making weight at 185 pounds. And I understand that the UFC at a certain point said, hey, just move up and wait. And it is bad, kind of, how there's no in-between between middleweight and light heavyweight. It's just a 20-pound gap. But Roberson is too big for middleweight, probably too small for light heavyweight, but against someone like Khalil Roundtree Jr., who is not going to go in there to grapple at all, I don't think we are going to see those weaknesses show their head in this fight. But let's say Roberson does win this one, and then he is matched up against even like a Tyson Page, or I don't even know why he came to mind, but someone who will grapple quite a bit with their wrestling and is really wrestling heavy, even though he's not much of a threat on the feet. The wrestling and the overall grappling defense of Roberson is such a big Achilles heel that I'm always going to worry about it for as long as he's in the UFC, even though, like you said, he does have good submission wins.
And the craziest part about it, I mean, in Carl Roberson's corner, the fight that he had against Marvin Vettori, like, the way he was able to buck out, like, really early on, like, it was a lot of fun, but he ended up getting caught and he ended up getting finished. And for Carl Roberson, getting ready for his last fight that he was supposed to have against Nick Maximov, I went back and did a little bit of research on that one. He was actually training out of Glory MMA and Fitness for that fight. He's been a killer bee combat sports guy out in the New Jersey, New York area. And he's training at Cantone's MMA with Corey Anderson. Again, same team. He's been around those guys for a really long time to get ready for this fight. Whereas Khalil Roundtree has gone from Kings to Tiger Muay Thai to, for his last fight, Syndicate. He's also at Syndicate again for this one. So you're going to get some rounds in there with, I mean, who the hell knows if Sean Strickland's still there, but there are a lot of bigger fighters at Syndicate to get some time in the cage with. So for Roundtree, coming in off that win, before that, the loss to Prakniel, where, yeah, he hurt poor old Marcin Prakniel.
Who hasn't, though?
But then he just stood there and bobbed and
please don't do that motion ever again.
Didn't really do a whole lot. Lose to Juan Kutsalaba, where he gets taken down over and over again. It just really has been a mixed bag for both of these guys. Carl Roberson submitting Roman Kopylov, the old boxer. I never thought that would happen, but it did. But even that, I mean, Carl Roberson's last win, 2 years and 2 months ago. Like, it's crazy. It really is.
And I still favor him in this matchup, because with Roberson, the wrestling and the grappling gets him into trouble. But if you do just allow him to strike for striking's sake, he's very, very good at it. With Roundtree, even if you let him have range and let him have his own timing and his rhythm, he just doesn't have output a lot of the time. So unless he is able to hurt Roberson with a big shot early on, I just think Roberson's going to be able to stand in the middle of the cage and really pick Roundtree apart from range.
So when we look at this one in terms of the odds for this fight, for Khalil Roundtree, a slight favorite, a minus 125 or thereabouts. For Carl Roberson, plus 105. We look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. 613 total votes, 78% for Roundtree, 73% by knockout. For the 22% that have Carl Roberson, 47% by decision, 16% by submission, 33% by knockout. For Baby K, the weird thing is, I would expect him in this fight to maybe try and implement some grappling. Khalil Roundtree, not necessarily known for his takedown defense either, so that really is a big key.
He's a lot stronger, though, and that's why I don't think he will.
That is it, and he's one of those, you can see it in the picture, he's an upper body strength type of guy. So if Roberson's able to get the takedown, that would be a method of victory. With Roundtree, other than the Prakniel fight, you like it when he's actually able to start to throw in combination, when he's listening to the coaches, and when he flows, because when he doesn't, it can get ugly like that one fight. But again, I look at this one, I ever so slightly edge the favorite in Khalil Roundtree in this one, because for Carl Roberson, I just haven't seen it in so long. And that's the thing, like, yes, he can flow when he strikes, but he doesn't normally do that. He usually reverts to the grappling, so it is tricky.
Well, he does after he gets his opponent hurt a lot of the times, and that's why I do think he's going to be able to just stay at range and kick a lot with Roundtree. I don't think either guy's going to throw a lot of output. I do think this is going to be very much a mirror match, but that's why I do like Roberson's ability to just find the holes through the defense of Roundtree a little bit more effectively.
Matt going with the underdog, and Carl Roberson in this fight, looking for his first win in a couple of years. I'm going with Khalil Roundtree out of Syndicate to get the win. You let us know down below in the comments section what you make of the light heavyweight division and who you have winning this fight. We got a couple of big time fights left on this card. Your co-main event, Song Yadong taking on Marlon Moraes, the former title challenger, and with another former title challenger in the main event, Thiago Santos taking on Magomed Ankalaev. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say,
let's get into it.
Alex Caceres has had a wild ride of a career, from coming in off the Ultimate Fighter Season 12 at lightweight to having a fight of the night and submission of the night performance against Sergio Pettis at bantamweight to now being on a 5-fight win streak in 2022. It's been an amazing run for Bruce Leroy. You see it up on the screen. He's got his own gym now that he trains out of in Florida. You absolutely love to see good things happening to a guy that's been there and done that, like a split decision loss in a great fight against Yair Rodriguez. Just some of the highlights of an overall great body of work. But if you look at it for Alex Caceres and those 5 fights, he's had to withstand a little bit of adversity. He's pulled ahead in fights that he wasn't favored to win. Wins over Steven Peterson, Chase Hooper, Austin Springer, Kevin Kroom. And his last time out against Sungmoo Choi, where Caceres was bobbing and weaving on the outside, moving around, gets hit by a nice 1-2 from Sting, gets dropped. And Sungmoo Choi, I assumed, was going to finish the fight in that moment, but he didn't. And then, as the fight wears on, Alex Caceres just kind of runs in and snatches up the back. It was kind of a crazy transition, the way that he was able to get it. But, man, Alex Caceres just proving the doubters wrong, continuing to be on the winning ways. And for Sadiq Youssef, coming off of just his second professional loss his last time out there against Arnold Allen. But even in Sadiq Youssef's fights, I mean, he rallies back in the third round. He really took over that fight against Arnold Allen. But in the first round, he gets knocked down. In the first round of his fight against Gabriel Benitez, he gets wobbled down to where he did kind of a dance floor move and then popped back up off the floor. I know that might not count as a knockdown, but it's a knockdown in that one. So for Youssef, he's one of those guys that really does a good job of trying to land power, close the distance, land those big shots, get that finish. And we saw that. I mean, his fight against Mike Davis on Dana White's Contender Series was wild. But if you like Mike Davis, I mean, I stack him up there right now with some of those top fighters, even though he doesn't fight that often. I think he's a great fighter. But for Youssef, that's definitely a marquee win. But usually in a Youssef fight, there's a little bit of adversity early before he really starts to implement his own game plan, if he's not able to finish it early on his own.
That's why this is the perfect fight for Sadiq Youssef. Listen, I know everyone's excited about Alex Caceres being on a 5-fight win streak. I would include myself in that category. Terrible stylistic matchup for Alex Caceres, though, because Caceres is someone who really relies on his volume and sort of pitter-patter style to gain a lot of momentum in his fights. Sadiq Youssef doesn't mind eating a shot to land one of his own, and yes, in some of his fights, it does cost him. But Caceres doesn't have that much power, especially at this weight class. So, in my mind's eye, I know some people might be down on Youssef based on his last performance, and people might be hyped up about Caceres based off his few previous fights. But Youssef is still a top-tier featherweight in this division, at least I believe so. And I always almost expect him to fight, like, maybe a Dane Ige type next. Like, I really do think Sadiq Youssef is an entrenched top 15 member, to where he's going to be in the rankings for a very, very long time. Because this is something I think we all have made a big mistake of doing, and I put myself to the front of this line. Arnold Allen's one of the best featherweights in the world, but nobody talks about him like he is, and I think we should finally start giving him that respect, because he looked great against Sadiq Youssef, and like you said, the problem for Youssef is that no one questions his skills. It's just the inactivity does hurt him, especially with his placement in the rankings. And the same thing has to be said for Arnold Allen, too. Allen is a phenomenal talent, but he only fights once a year, once every 15 months. If he was able to be more consistent, I really do think we'd be talking about Arnold Allen as, like, people are going to think this is wild, but
he's a top 10 ranked fighter.
But he should fight, like, Brian Ortega, Yair Rodriguez. I think he's ready for those types of tests in this division. I really do. And I think Sadiq Youssef had a competitive fight with him. I know he lost, but still, it says that he's in the top 10, in the top 12. And for Caceres, all of his opponents on this recent 5-fight win streak, other than Choi his last time out, I would say are sort of UFC entry-level type talents. Kroom's good, don't get me wrong. But he's exciting.
Springer's not.
Exactly. Springer's
Chase
not.
Hooper's
Hooper,
not.
Very young in his career.
Peterson.
See, it's a lot of fun wins. They're good to get excited about because, again, a lot of people had completely read off the career of Alex Caceres as, hey, he's sort of a journeyman. He's a little over the hump. We'll build these prospects off of his name. It's been really impressive to see this run that he has gone on, but I think this is one step way too far. Beating Chase Hooper, and let's be honest, getting out-grappled by him early and having some, let's say, questionable exchanges even on the feet with him makes me really nervous when you're about to strike with a guy like Sadiq Youssef, who has absolute bricks in his hands.
I mean, the Arnold Allen take, I don't know, that's like a Wendy's hot, like, spicy chicken sandwich. It's just a tingle, because he's in the top
five. You don't make a lot of hot takes on this channel, Craig, so I think that's a pretty spicy one.
It's not that spicy.
I think Arnold Allen would beat Brian Ortega if they fought. There you go.
I don't think so. But when I look at this fight, Matt, for Sadiq Youssef, he's one of those guys that the one thing that I worry about in a fight against Alex Caceres is the fact that He tries to cut the cage, but sometimes you watch him, and I can't draw it. I'm not like a Luke Thomas. I don't have a board. Maybe one day we'll do that. But I watch him, and he starts to cut it. His opponent turns the corner, and then he's following them. And then they end up back in the center of the cage. He has a really hard time sometimes with trying to cut it so he can land those power shots. And again, he has to withstand a lot of adversity in some of his fights. Now, Arnold Allen, like you said, I think he gets the respect. I just don't think he gets, you know, the name recognition because he doesn't fight all that often. But when you look at it, the fight against Gabriel Benitez, he does withstand a little bit of that. And if we focus on some of those wins, Andre Feely, that was a big-time win for him. He became a U.S. citizen after that fight, so that was kind of neat for him. The win over Benitez, a win over Shaymon Moraes, and then before that, Suman Mokhtarian. Yikes, those Mokhtarian brothers, they had a rough go in the UFC. But for Sadiq Youssef, this is definitely a big name if he's able to get that win. So we have a look at the odds. Youssef open minus 225, minus 235 or thereabouts right now. For Caceres, plus 190, plus 195 or thereabouts. If we have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over-under, 82.5% Youssef.
Should be over if they're not.
They are not. So 558 total votes, 71% Youssef, 73% by decision, 21% by knockout. For the 29% that have Caceres, 60% by decision, 33% by submission, a slim margin, have him to win by knockout. I like Sadiq Youssef in this fight. And again, we talk about it. He will not wrestle offensively in this fight. And if he does, it's a big mistake. It really is.
Wait, what? I think he could have grappled Caceres on the mat if he gets on top of him.
I don't think you're going to see that. That's what I'm saying.
He took down Andre Feely in their fight, though, and Andre Feely's a good wrestler. He out-wrestled Dennis Bermudez.
I don't think we're going to see that in this fight. What I do think we'll see is the constant forward motion of Sadiq Youssef with Caceres on the back foot. And Caceres is a good fighter on the back foot. He tends to land a lot of good volume, but that's just it. When we're talking volume and then volume with power, I really do like that out of Sadiq Youssef in this match.
I really do think Youssef is going to be competitive with a lot of guys in the top 15. I think he had a really competitive fight with another great fighter his last time out, but I do expect him to get back on the winning track in this fight. I think it's been really nice to see what Caceres has done in this later stage of his career, because again, a lot of people just kind of wanted to use him as a road bump for the Chase Hoopers of the world and some of the other prospects, but it's been nice to see him go on this run, although I do expect it to end this weekend.
I would not anchor anything to this, because I did the last time with Sung Choi, and I got proven wrong in that one, but a big time fight coming up this weekend. Both of us going with Super Sadiq Youssef to pick up the W and continue to move forward. Hopefully we get to see him fight more in this loaded featherweight division. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Two big fights left, one at bantamweight, one at light heavyweight. We want to rock and roll through. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Finally, a fight night co-main event that I can get behind, and fingers crossed, knock on wood, that this one happens. We have Magic Marlon Moraes taking on Sung Yadong out of Team Alpha Male, and that's just it. I mean, you look at Sung Yadong, comes into the UFC at 2017, a very, very young man with a lot of experience already, and he inserts himself into the division at some of the lower rankings, and he's able to come out, gain performance bonuses, really showcases great boxing while sticking with the gym at Team Alpha Male from that young age. Marlon Moraes, a guy who's kind of bounced around a little bit. He's been in New Jersey. He's been an American Top Team. And out of his last five fights, we know that his fifth to last fight was a fight against Henry Cejudo, where he looked like a man on fire at the start. And then he slowed down, and then he ends up losing. He picks up a big win on the rebound against Jose Aldo by split decision. But again, argument could be made either way. But it's really been the way that he's lost his last three fights and the fact that they happened in such short succession, including his last fight about 5 months ago to Mrav Dvashvili, where the story of those three fights, he does something good in all of those three fights. And then he gets finished in emphatic fashion. He switched it up and gone to Tiger Muay Thai for this camp. So it's a bit of a surprise to me that he's decided to really try and refine the striking, which we know that that is a really good point of his game. And obviously he has the wrestling to round things out, but he has gotten finished again in impressive fashion in his last three fights. And it really is a shame to see that out of a fighter that's so all action that this is the way that those three fights have gone.
Marlon at one point was on the verge of being in the top 15 pound for pound a couple years ago. Like, people forget how good he was when he beat Rafael Assuncao, I guess the second time they fought, because he lost the first one by a controversial decision, although I thought Assuncao had won that fight. He has legit knockout power, insane submission ability if he is able to latch on to any submission. The wrestling is a slight bit of a weak point for him, but again, when he's so good at submitting people and so good at knocking them out, you don't really have to worry about your wrestling that much if you are someone like Marlon Moraes. This is what makes it so interesting for him, though. He's a phenomenal striker, but let's just call a spade, he can't eat a shot at this stage of his career. And I don't even mean he's in the boat where if he eats a clean hook, it might put him down. Like, even a really clean jab has shown the ability to at least rock Marlon. And he's not one of these fighters who... Who's a good example? Michael Bisping got dropped a lot throughout his MMA career, but he didn't get knocked out a ton because he was able to recover really fast if he was dropped. Marlon is the opposite side of that spectrum, to where once he is hurt, it's really hard for him to get back into the fight, and he's not someone who can just sort of jump up a couple times or hold on and clinch for a few seconds and get their whereabouts back. You'll see it. He still tries to create separation and almost fight like the Marlon who is unrocked. Go back to the Rob Font fight. He hurts Rob Font with a clean shot on the inside, takes him down, has a lot of success early on, but the second Rob Font puts any type of combinations together, he hurts Marlon. But instead of going back to the wrestling, which he had success with early when he wasn't rocked, he tries to go back into range and throws like two wheel kicks, just bam, bam. Now, is that a really smart plan by Marlon? Of course not. He got knocked out very quick after. But I do think that the damage is just really taking a toll on Marlon at this stage of his career. And on the other side of this fight, I'm probably not the conductor of the hype train of Song Yadong, but I really do think he's one of the brightest prospects in the UFC. I think he's either 1A or 1B at this point, because when you look at his strengths, he has everything. He has great offensive wrestling, good defensive wrestling, although that is a weakness for him if we're going to get into, you know, if we're going to put a magnifying glass on all of his skills. But he doesn't have any massive weaknesses in his game against just an average fighter. Yes, a top-tier collegiate wrestler can take him down, but he can strike with the best strikers. He can wrestle with pretty much anybody at the division. It's just going to be interesting to see. How does he continue to evolve his skill set moving forward? Will he still try to maintain the boxing style? Will he start adding more kicks to his game? Because, like you said, came to the UFC at a very young age. And let's be honest, when you have people coming into the UFC at 21 years of age with 10, 15 fights already, you always kind of worry about the level of competition and, oh, is this person going to be the real deal or not? But Song Yadong has proved that he's one of these young fighters who came in UFC ready, and he has been able to improve from that point on. This is just an awful fight to give Marlon at this stage of his career. Like, I don't know if him and Dana White don't get along, but you have a guy who has been finished in multiple fights, and let's be honest, he's been hit late in some of these. Like, they're not just average TKO losses Marlon has been on the receiving end of. He's eaten a lot of damage, and now he's fighting a guy who's just shown ever-increasing finishing ability throughout his MMA career. I just think stylistically, this is one of those, hey, Song, you're a pretty exciting prospect. Let's try to get you some fans now.
Like, a performance bonus over Barat Kandari, performance bonus over Felipe Arantes, performance bonus over Ultimate Fighter winner Alejandro Perez. Fight in the night against Marlon Vera, where he's able to get the win there. He loses to Kyler Phillips. Again, wrestling. A little bit of a question there. Wrestling against Cody Stamann in that decision, but he did shine when he was able to strike. And then, to me, that marquee win, his last time out. I mean, you knock out...
He destroyed Julio
You knock Arce. Out Julio Arce. That really is a big tell for me. Now, again, both these guys debuted in 2017. For Song Yadong, it was back in November of that year. For Marlon, it was in June. But, I mean, he was at the top of the mountain with World Series of Fighting coming in. So they gave him Assuncao, who was a top-ranked guy. He loses that fight. Beats John Dodson. Performance bonus over Aljamain Sterling. Performance bonus over Jimmy Rivera. Performance bonus over Assuncao. And then when he fights for the title, a great start. But that was all it was against Cejudo, and really the wheels kind of fell off after that. Now, he beats Aldo, like I said, but that one's really controversial. And then those three losses, and you touched on it. I mean, the fact that he had some success against Sandhagen, actually
gets his orbital broken and gets wheel kicked.
Out of the three fights, that was the least amount of success. Against Rob Font, nice clean shot. Offensive wrestling was good. Defensive wrestling is his whole out of the grappling. And then against Marab, I don't know how that fight didn't get finished. Like, he had him... dead to rights, out on his feet, and then Marab, being the crazy guy he is, he's just going to take off like a helicopter and throw spinning back fists like they're going out of style, but he gets himself back into that fight. And if you ever question Marab's heart, like his fight against Ricky Simone, like the guy just doesn't have any quit in him.
You might not get this reference, but it was the official sponsor of UFC 272 last night, but Elden Ring, it's a game that's getting a lot of hype right now. I'm playing, it's very good. The people on the internet will get it. Sometimes you fight bosses in that, and you beat them with no health left. That's exactly what Marab did. Like, he was as close to getting knocked out as you can possibly get in his matchup with Marlon, but he somehow was able to just keep on moving when the ref was asking for something, keep on moving to an advantageous position, and his pace is what really broke Marlon at the end of that fight, and that's the last thing that I worry about. I worry about Marlon getting caught early in this matchup, but I also worry about his cardio if it does go late, because yes, he was steady against Aldo, but for the most part, he is a bit of a front runner in his fights.
If Marlon can go out there, especially with the Tiger Muay Thai camp for this one, initiate the leg kick early against Song Yadong, whose boxing is so great and crisp, what happens when he has to switch stances? I'm sure that's a big part of that game plan of a Marlon Moraes. But we look at the odds for this one. Marlon open a plus 155. He's around a plus 200. For Song Yadong, open a minus 180. He's a minus 250. We have a look over on Tapology. If I had to guess, because the votes are a surprise to us, there to you, I'm going to say 80% over under Song Yadong.
I would say over.
You're going to say over, and I glance by them. They're close. 594 total votes. 76% Song Yadong, 77% by knockout. For the 24% that I'm Marlon, 49% by decision, 40% by knockout. Again, as I just mentioned, if Marlon comes out, kick heavy, head back, and we're just working, trying to attack that lead leg early to then set up Marlon's combinations, that would be a welcome surprise. But the thing that bugs me, as you said, Marlon, when he gets hit and he tries to recover, he backs up and almost leaves his chin out. Like, it's just, it goes so many levels of bad for Marlon when it goes bad. And I can see it going bad on Saturday night.
It's Song Yadong's interesting because he doesn't really have one-punch knockout power just in the center of the cage, but he's got great timing on the in-between. So while his opponent's opening themselves up to throw a strike, that's when he'll hit them on the in-between. Go back and watch the Perez fight. It's just a really good example of that. He throws a right hand right at the middle that, like, Pez dispensers his head back, and it could show what this fight could look like if Marlon does get in the pocket, exchanging strikes with Song Yadong. I like the younger fighter quite a bit in this matchup, and hopefully he is able to get some sort of shine, which will get him another big fight after this one.
Matt, in this one, are the skaters gonna skate? We're gonna figure out this weekend if somebody's gonna be skating in the middle of the octagon. Marlon Moraes taking on Song Yadong. Both of us going with Song Yadong to get the win in this fight. You let us know down below, because hopefully, knock on wood, this is a striker's paradise, and I can't wait for it. We have a big time fight coming up in our main event between Thiago Santos and Magomed Ankalaev. 5 rounds of light heavyweight action that you're not gonna want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Absolute banger. Light heavyweight in our main event coming up this weekend. We have the former title challenger who had a great claim, and especially one judge in agreement that he won the belt, Thiago Maheta Santos. And listen, if anybody's walkout that's out there in this world to get excited about, it is Thiago Santos. He's got his own song. It's a feel-good one. He danced a little bit, maybe a little bit less than he used to, but he does dance to it nonetheless. Coming into this fight, winning his last time out in a 5-round atmosphere, taking on Johnny Walker, where, to his credit, Thiago Santos didn't necessarily fight the average Thiago Santos fight. It wasn't just blood and guts and somebody gets knocked out at the end. He took a much more measured approach to it, and you like to see that game plan out of him, especially after the knees were wobbled and ruined against John Jones. And then he was on the losing end, after which he takes on Glover Teixeira and Alexander Rakic. So a good bounce back for Santos off that 3-fight losing streak. But for Magomed Ankalaev, since losing in his debut to Paul Craig, he's looked amazing. You look at the 5-on-in, Dalcolin Jambula, head kick knockout. Iwan Kutsalaba, did he knock him out? Didn't he knock him out? Well, he did the second time out. And then he beats Nikita Krylov, where he loses the first round and gets out grappled, but he rallies to win. And then he actually works his wrestling into that fight. And his last time out against Volkan Oezdemir, knocks him down in the first round. Volkan rallies in the second round. Third round, Ankalaev is the one that ends up getting it done. But ultimately, for Ankalaev, this isn't just a big test in taking on Thiago Santos. I think this is a big test going from 3-round fights to 5-round fights for him, because he can be measured in his approach, and I do like that, especially in a fight like this, but I think it will be a tough test, especially for him, because he can get beaten first round, second round. How is he going to react in the championship rounds if we make it there?
I always look at Ankalaev as someone who can kind of give rounds away, and that does worry me when he does start to fight these upper level guys at 205 pounds, because the weight class is sort of having a bit of a metamorphosis, if you will. A lot of the older fighters are starting to age themselves out, and you have these newer fighters like Ankalaev, like Jamal Hill's another guy who's starting to work his way to the top. And Jamal Hill's going to get brought up more than once as I break this fight down. But What Jamahal Hill has showed is, I'm extremely aggressive. And, unless I make a grave mistake with my fight IQ, I'm always going to be that aggressive fighter who has really good knockout power. Ankalaev has a lot of those same strengths, but sometimes he doesn't have the aggression to go along with them. And it is just sort of questionable as an observer. Go back and watch the Uzdemir fight. He has him dead to rights early in that, has him hurt, he's really outstriking him comfortably, but sort of settles into the fight, and I don't mean that in a positive way. Normally we mean that as, oh, he was a little wild early, but now he's a little bit more refined. Ankalaev will get off to a lead and almost kind of coast as the fight goes on. It'll be interesting to see how he fights Thiago Santos, because for Santos, we brought up the knees, I don't know how many times, people are probably sick and tired of us talking about ACLs here, but Santos has looked better being more removed from that injury. I do feel like he has gotten his legs under him a little bit more as of late, and the fight against Johnny Walker did prove that. I know he didn't finish Walker, and that might not be the best thing, like even though he did beat him, he didn't look great in the win, but he showed, I would say, improved lateral movement in that fight, and he had a pretty good gas tank too, to where he was able to lunge in from long distance and land his own shots without eating big counter shots as a result. But for Santos, this is how I guess I'll drop it back off to you. Like, where do you look at him in his career? Like, do you think he thinks, hey, if I beat Ankalaev, I'm right back up there for a title? Because I know the division is quite wide open. I don't still look at Thiago Santos as being a guy who can get up to the title shot. Maybe I'm putting more of a limitation on him than I should, but you see him lose to Rakic. It was a boring fight. It's not like Rakic really went out there and beat the brakes off him by any means, but we know what he looks like against Glover. He can't hang with him in the grappling department, although he did look good on the feet. He was able to drop him a couple times. I worry about Santos at this stage of his career, although I can fully admit this fight against Ankalaev is a very winnable one for him.
Like a year and a half ago, he drops Glover, rocks him in a couple of spots, and then even before that, we back it up. Now we're, 3 years removed from his fight against Jan Blachowicz, where he looked really good at the start, and then Jan just had that Polish power across
the cage.
Well,
he knocked out Jan.
He knocked out Jan, and he looked really good in that fight. And for Jan, he has the Polish power to come back and then end up as champion. But you look at it for Thiago Santos, obviously that John Jones fight changed something in his style a little bit. Like, he was aggressive against Glover.
The strength in his knees, probably.
The strength in his knees and those weird capoeira videos before that were definitely old
videos.
Like,
I have a friend named Leah who tore her ACL, and she's like, when it's cold outside, my knee hurts. Like, I couldn't imagine being a high-level athlete and still dealing with an injury like that when you're so reliant on your explosiveness.
But it's one of those things, too. And I mean, from the John Jones fight in July 2019 to then fighting November of 2020, and still being a little tender, I mean, again, Santos did look good on the feet, so we have to give him credit where it's due, but it was more with his hooks that he was able to throw. It wasn't necessarily big-time boxing combinations, and that's the thing with Thiago Santos. You're not going to see, like, 3-4 punch combos out of Santos. It's very much 1-2 power shot reset. I'm going to throw a spinning wheel kick like we were able to see in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada all those years ago. You love to see that. That one against Jack Marshman, a performance of the night bonus for him. But for Thiago Santos, a wild end cap to his career at 205 pounds. Obviously, fight of the night against Anders, where I don't know how that was a fight. Like, he beat the brakes off.
It was a good
him.
Fight, though. Anders had a couple moments.
He beats Jimmy Manoa. That was a wild fight. And then the fight against Jan Blachowicz, obviously a big-time one. But for me, to answer it, for Santos, kind of in no man's land. Like, I think a win for Ankalaev gets him a title shot. I think a win for Thiago Santos gets him another guy, like a rematch against Rakic. Like, it's really
right.
Is tough to say. So, for me,
Anthony Smith at 205 would be a fun fight for them to revisit.
Rematch. I always love that one. I agree with you there. So, I look at this matchup. For Magomed Ankalaev, we talk about the ranges that both of these guys fight in. For you, do you think a matchup here stylistically benefits Ankalaev a little bit more than it does for Santos?
It's really going to be interesting because I don't hold Ankalaev striking in the highest regard. He's a good striker, but again, the lack of volume really does concern me, especially when he does fight these other primary strikers. And I'm going to bring up Jamahal Hill's name again because if he fought someone like Jamahal Hill, like, that's the type of opponent that would worry you if you are an Ankalaev supporter, because if Ankalaev starts out really strong and just kind of coasts afterwards, well, Jamahal Hill's going to keep on moving forward, throwing his power shots, trying to find a way to end the fight no matter what. So for Ankalaev, I think this is an opportunity to really prove to us that, wow, he could fight for a title, or maybe he could just be an average ranked light heavyweight, because I think he has to look good in this fight for me to really take him as a contender seriously. I don't think just a win will be good enough for me to think, wow, Ankalaev all of a sudden is destined for the top five, and The odds are wild on this fight, if I'm being completely honest. I don't know why Ankalaev is the sizable favorite that he is, because I think there's a world out there where this fight follows the exact same script. And I mean the exact same script as the Johnny Walker one, where you have two guys who realize that they both have power, who are both a little bit hesitant on the outside, because, like you said, Santos at this stage of his career isn't the same wild man who's just going to rush his opponent. And Ankalaev...
Which he was.
It would be nice, wouldn't it? And Ankalaev, he'll either have a slow start and start to build in his fights, or have a strong start and start to slow in his fights. Either scenario is going to give Thiago Santos opportunities to land his own punches and his own power shots, and that's why I do think this fight is very close on paper, but I do think that when it is at long range, I think the kicks of Ankalaev, especially to the leg, are going to give Santos problems at this stage of his career.
Kicks to the leg of Ankalaev, he is a striker with his kicks where he can mix it up to all three levels, not just to the leg, not just to the body. His head kick, I mean, the front kick to Dalcha, the kicks that he's able to land, they're absolutely insane. When he throws his combinations too, he's the type of guy that's incredibly precise with his boxing as well. You like to see that out of Ankalaev. He's been in the States for a couple weeks if you look at his Instagram, so no issues there. We look at the odds for this one. Ankalaev open, a minus 155 or thereabouts. Minus 466 as of now on best fight odds. The average for Santos open plus 135, plus 346. If we have a look at Tapology, I mean, listen, it's going to end up being a surprise to us as it is to you. I'm going to say over under, Matt, 87.5% Ankalaev.
I'll say under, but he'll be the favorite.
92% of 703 total votes going with Ankalaev, 52% by decision, 38% by knockout. So, Matt, again, like, it really is.
This fight to me is much closer than anybody else is making it out to be right now. Like, the opening odds made a lot of sense for me because, honestly, Ankalaev is still somewhat unproven. I know he beat Ustemir and he has looked good, but again, we talk about middleweight and light heavyweight as being two of the weaker divisions. When you're only beating borderline ranked guys in these divisions and you're barely doing it, it does make me really question you when you do make that step up into the sort of primetime competition levels.
So we throw it on over there to the YouTube community tab. What is it? 533 wow. Votes so far. 87% Ankalaev. Drew Cliff 82 saying, I really hope Ankalaev. He should win, and I feel that he's better for the division. If he wins, he should face Rakic for the number one contender. Another fight they should do is Anthony Smith versus Jan. I'd be down for that one too. I'd sooner see Santos versus Smith as the rematch. Selman Bundy saying, Magomed Ankalaev lock. Right place, right time. Thiago aging. And the Man Cave saying, who was there in the chat for question mark kicks and for the sidekick, give me Ankalaev to win via decision. Anthony saying, Thiago Santos, LOL, just kidding. So trolling as it is. I like Ankalaev in this matchup, but again, yeah, those odds give me heavy pause as he is a heavy favorite because I like the combinations. I like the kicks. With Santos, he used to be able to just burst forward and really end guys' nights quick, and he was able
Jack
to go in there.
Manson fight where he just sprints across throwing that like uppercut over and over again.
Yeah, there's so many things to like out of that burst, out of the explosiveness, but with the legs where they're at, with the age, it does scare me that way. And with Ankalaev, again, beating Paul Craig until he gets submitted and every other fight he's had, the thing that scares me with Ankalaev, if you really, really like him at that price point, is against Krylov, he loses the first round and gets out grappled. Now he comes back in that fight. Against Volkan Ozdemir, he nearly has him finished, and then he coasts, and then he loses the second round, so he has to win the third round. Like, these aren't things that I like to see out of a guy when he's facing, like, 20 to 10 guys. Now we're taking on the top guys, but it is light heavyweight. It's a weaker division.
Jure Prochazka came out of the scene, and I felt very comfortable saying this guy's going to be eventually in a title picture at some point, or at least be in a long-time main event picture, if that makes sense. He can main event many fight night cards. For Ankalaev, he's only in this position because of his opponent. Like, Thiago Santos is the A side for this fight, so Ankalaev really does need an impressive performance to really get people on his side to take him seriously in this division. I think he's going to get the win, but I got to be honest. And I don't often say this. I don't think this is going to be a great fight. I really do think this is going to be a low volume, very methodical. And I know that's weird to say that that's going to give Thiago Santos a chance to win this fight. But I do see a world where Ankalaev wins round one, might even drop Santos round two, and then just sort of coast. And maybe the significant strike numbers will be like 13-9. They'll be really close every round, you know what I mean? And at the end, it'll be, oh, split decision, Thiago Santos wins. Because you'll have two rounds definitely for Ankalaev, three rounds that were pretty 50-50, but we all know how judges are nowadays. I'm going to pick Ankalaev, but boy, do those odds scare me.
Big time fight coming up this weekend in the main event. Both of us going with Ankalaev to maybe get a title shot, maybe end up in a number one contender's bout. And it is interesting when you look at these rankings, both of these guys up near the top of the division. Thiago Santos at 5, Ankalaev at 6. Ahead of them, you have Smith, Rakic, Prochazka, and Jan Blachowicz. And for Prochazka, that title shot. Ooh,
I'm
boy.
So excited for that fight.
What a fight with Glover Teixeira. A big one on the horizon. You let us know down below in that comment section. Get it popping all week long. We'll have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. That question mark kicks parlay. I mean, we're just putting it on a tee and hitting that one out of the park the last couple of weeks. Big opportunity coming up this weekend with 14 fights. The debuts, the second looks. It is a big time fight night card, Matt. I can't wait for it.
It's going to be a good one. This is by far the best fight night card of the year, and I hope we're going to enjoy it.
Toss a like, toss a sub if you haven't already, so you can keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.